This is Dr. Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Martin Brady. Mr. Brady's in Garland, Texas. I am still in Lubbock, Texas, and today is July 9th, 2003. It's about 1:15 p.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Brady, we left off, we were in your second tour, and before we started recording here today, we were discussing some time changes from our last interview. Do you want to go ahead and mention those?
The one change was that when we returned from the TDY mission, we returned in December of 63, and we got back to work, I guess, in January of 64. And I think I mentioned that we went on some flyaways teaching the reserves.
Yes,
and that wasn't completely correct. It was, we actually went on that mission to Fort Devens, and then when we returned from that, we trained for, it was either the Mercury Project or Apollo or one of the astronaut programs where we would go in and secure the return vehicle until they could be evacuated.
Okay.
And then we went into serious mission training for the PCS move in December of 64. That was the only thing I wanted to update.
Okay, very good. Let's pick up with that second tour. You had discussed some of your activities there, building the Special Forces camp, running some ops, search and destroy, interdiction, et cetera. Let's talk about, when you think back at that second tour, how do you see Vietnam changing? Did you see changes from the first time you were over there the year previous? Could you tell the war was increasing in pace? Again, this is, you're there before the major buildup and then when the major buildup begins in 65.
Yeah.
What did you witness?
Well, basically when we got there, I mean, the people don't change and, you know, the terrain is pretty much the same. when we went over in 63, we lived in a tent city up at the main headquarters, which was then a C team. And when we got back in 64, they had improved it a lot, and they were getting ready for the PCS people. They were already starting on permanent buildings then. But you could, you know, there was more more Americans there, more business going on, more, they, I think by then they had some type of AFRTS, the radio was going, I think it was going at that time. But there was more, you know, interest, it seemed, in the war and more news coverage or more media coverage, so that was a change.
Okay. Did you see a change in the enemy when you would go out on these operations?
Yeah, they were, you know, in larger numbers. And we knew that they had been building up on the other side of the border and had caches there, and, you know, they used it as a sanctuary, and they'd come fight us and then run back, knowing we couldn't, you know, aggressively pursue them.
How much did that frustrate you?
It did in ways, and it didn't, because we knew what to expect, you know. And, you know, tomorrow's another day. And we caught him with his pants down a couple of times and surprised him a few times. It kind of made up for the times he surprised us.
Okay. When you think back to that second tour, what memorable incidents come to mind? What do you see in your mind's eye?
After the camp was built, we really aggressively patrolled the whole area there. And I guess the reports we were sending in and the agent reports we got from our intel man, and they started paying a little more attention to the area. We got they started talking about putting other camps closer, and you know, making max use of the setup that we had. And of course, they increased the number of airboats that we got because we used them pretty well. Things of that nature. They, you know, bolstered things. We got a civil affairs augmentation to work with the people around there. And as I think I did mention that around that camp was a lot of Wahao and cow dye.
Yes, sir.
There was religious sects, so that played into it. I think initially when we went there, they didn't really know how to take us, and they weren't as cooperative. As they turned out to be. We got, you know, both sects into the strike force. We recruited them, and, you know, they, that runs all the way over into Tainan province.
Mm-hmm. How did you recruit them?
More or less, it was they needed, they wanted the money. You know, mm-hmm. we were paying halfway decent wage for you know, people that didn't have much else other than fishing and farming mm-hmm. to make any money. And to do that, they needed to travel by boat and go long distances to the, you know, either the district headquarters or, you know, province headquarters, mm-hmm. or move on up to Makwa. And then they ended up paying the Viet Cong tax or, you know, whatever. They were getting hosed either way, I guess. So.
Mm-hmm. Did you sense amongst these two groups, I guess, an increased fierceness or an increased independence from the regular Vietnamese civilians based on their history of kind of resisting colonization and then resisting the Viet Cong?
Yeah, that and they were, you know, they were pretty feisty as a group anyway, you know,
mm-hmm.
but you know, of course the leader of one sect, I think, had been assassinated by the communists, or
mm-hmm.
One of the leaders was assassinated either by the NBA or the BC or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
That kind of helped out the recruiting. So.
Right.
But yeah, it seemed that the people we faced there had better knowledge of tactics,
mm-hmm.
Made better uses of mission support sites and that thing, that
mm-hmm.
type of thing, and of course the weapons were better,
mm-hmm.
and probably they had more ammunition than you know, we usually ran into.
Right, right. During this tour, did you get to take any R&R?
It was offered. Actually, then, I don't think they actually had anything R&R out of country.
Mm-hmm.
But they started something then on that tour that it was an individual replacements.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't send teams anymore. They started sending people. No, that came later. Okay. The thing that they started there was that if you were in a hot camp, they try to get you out of the hot camp after 6 months and then
mm-hmm.
send you to a camp, you know, that might be less hot or, you know,
mm-hmm.
at least it was a change of scenery anyway.
They would send you individually or as a unit?
Individually.
Huh. Did that disrupt the unit cohesiveness?
I thought it did, and I argued against it, and I talked the team leader into letting me stay my full year there because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I knew the terrain. I knew all the, you know, the paths and the mm-hmm. canals and the whatevers,
mm-hmm.
and I knew the troops.
Right.
And I thought that was an advantage. And the fella that I was going to be swapped with, the medic up in one of the other camps up by the Seven Mountains, I think, he had a good program going, so he didn't want to leave there his place either.
Mm-hmm.
He had a really good med cap thing. I think the guy either got killed or captured later on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was up in, I believe, in the Seven Mountains area. But that happened, and he didn't want to leave, and I didn't want to leave, so they said, okay, we'll just leave you where you're at.
Right. Okay.
That PCS move later on, I got that confused with just, you know, the individual rotation.
Right.
But later on, they did get R&Rs, regularly scheduled R&Rs to,
mm-hmm.
to Thailand or Australia or... And, you know, if you extended, you could go to Hawaii and
mm-hmm.
this and that.
Mm-hmm. What is your opinion of the one-year tour? Do you think that the United States military or the government should have kind of treated the Vietnam War like they did previous wars, where you would serve the duration of the conflict, or did you think the one-year tour was appropriate?
I thought a year tour, from my way of looking at it, was long enough. There were people there that just stayed over there, you know, but
mm-hmm.
the... where I spent all four tours on an A-team.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically 12 Americans and whatever little people you need,
mm-hmm.
you know, for that given area. But I think after a year, you're due for a change. And I think, I don't know, I never really thought about it much until just in the last few years, but it just seemed like when you left, you know, you'd be back in 6 months or a year anyway. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, you got that chance to cool off and, you know, regroup and
mm-hmm.
Get your head straight again and go back.
How hard was it for you to transition after that year and go back? And then your subsequent tours, how difficult was it to kind of go back stateside, regroup, as you said?
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't want to tell you now or tell you later. But there was one incident that, I was out on a recon mission in 67.
Mm-hmm. And this is the tour following?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I get a call on the phone. Everything was code names and numbers and CAC codes and that kind of thing. And they CAC'd up the thing and said, okay, you're... the 1-0 is the team leader, 1-1 is the second in charge, and then the 1-2 is a radio man, and then just the opposite, 0-1 is the little people team leader, and you know, this kind of thing. So he said, okay, we want your 1-1 extracted, send him back to camp. And I was the 1-1 at the time, and I told the team leader, I says, you know, that's me. I said, there's only one thing they'd want me back for, and it's just death in the family. And I said, well, it's too late now anyway. If they're dead, there's nothing I can do. So just tell them, no, I ain't going out. It'll, you know, it'll give away, you know, you guys' position and just, you know, be a bad situation all around.
Mm-hmm.
So the headquarters insisted that the 1-1 get out. So then they verified that it was me, and they got me out. Well, I went from a bomb crater across the border to New Jersey within 30 hours, say.
Wow.
I got, you know, hot orders to, you know, get them back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I get there and went to the funeral. My mom had died. Went to the funeral and all, got back, and my niece, who was then, I guess, about 15 or 16 years old, asked me if I wanted to see her bathing suit that she was going to wear to, you know, spring break and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sure. I thought she was going to bring this food out. Well, she come out in the thing.
Okay.
And there's this voluptuous teenager, you know, I mean, this kid is beyond her age, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I just went, you know, it's just, I said, holy Andy, you know, going from bomb crater in Laos.
Right.
And then back to the States, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's this kid, you know, and then the next week I'm gone again.
Right.
Going right back. But, yeah, it's a hell of a transition to... But, you know, once you've been there and returned, it's common, you know. It doesn't require that much of a... Because, like I say, you get this attitude that you're going to be back in 6 months to a year anyway. That war's never going to end.
Right.
You know, it used to be a fun saying, you know, what are you going to do, send me to Vietnam?
Right.
You know, and bend my dog tags? Because you knew you were going back. That war was going to last forever.
Mm-hmm.
But... No, some guys couldn't adjust. They couldn't transition, and some of them probably never should have went back to the States. They should have just stayed over there. You know?
Let me ask you this about Special Forces in general. Some of my discussions with Special Forces men, they've talked about sometimes an overt, sometimes under the table rivalry between Special Forces, Army, and other branches, say the Marine Corps and other branches. Did you see any of that?
Not really. There's, you know, always some rivalry, you know, and everybody, you know, the Department of Defense had set the rules, you know. Special Forces, you got this mission, okay, and you, anything 12 miles behind the beach and forever after is yours. SEAL UDT, you guys got between 50 leagues out at sea to the first mile and a half of beach.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Marines have the, you know, force recon, you've got it from there to there or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the terrain was kind of, you know, cut and dried, but, you know, it was good natured. It wasn't any serious, you know, rivalry or anything
right.
at all. But,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. But even within Special Forces, we had the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Recon people were the, you know, creme de la creme, you know.
And, mm-hmm.
They looked down on the REMF, you know, rear echelon people.
Mm-hmm.
And even the A-team people. You know, nothing's really serious I can remember now.
Okay. Anything since Vietnam that has come up in that sense?
Well, one thing was... The unit started training together more.
Right.
We went to the first Spec War X in the Philippines, and that was the Air Force, Navy SEALs, Army Special Forces. We even had the Filipino UDT people there.
When was this?
That was, I think, in 76.
Mm-hmm.
That was at Subic Bay. But, yeah, we trained with the force recon people in Cuba. Went down to Guantanamo with them and sub-ops with them. And, you know, we got along pretty good, pretty well.
Okay, okay. So you returned to the States after this tour in December 1965.
Yeah.
Were you in time for Christmas?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, it was, you know, after the assassination and, you know, the first tour and the second tour, it was a little more, you know, I think that's the full Christmas. You know, we had the full Christmas at home instead of, you know, halfway there. It was, for a family my size, you know, you couldn't help but have a joyous Christmas, no matter what kind of mood you were in, you know.
Okay. Was it difficult for you to transition back after this full year in Vietnam?
No, not really. I didn't sense any change in me that much. You know, the family might have, but they never talked about it, or they didn't talk in front of me that way.
How much did you discuss what happened in Vietnam when you came back?
Certain things, you know. It really wasn't that widespread, you know. They knew what was going on, and they knew that I had been there before. And they didn't really pursue anything. You know, if I wanted to talk about something, they just go along with it. And they might, you know, if I volunteered anything, they might want me to expand on it or something. Mm-hmm. But no problem there.
Were you volunteering information, or were you?
At times, yeah. We'd bring back a memory, you know. Especially my brother, you know, because I used to go out hunting with him, and we'd talk. And, you know, he was in the Navy, and he knew basically, you know, the GI way, you know. And he never pushed, made me uncomfortable anyway.
Right, okay. When you returned from leave, where did you go?
I went back to the 5th, and basically I was with the same detachment, although, you know, the natural transition, you know, people moving on to another assignment and all.
This is at Fort Bragg?
Yes.
Okay.
And I went back to the same company, and I got transferred to another team. My team was kind of just sitting on their hands after the Christmas, New Year break, I heard about this thing going on up to Fort Devens to be aggressors against the 5th Mechanized Division, or 2nd Battalion of that division. Wasn't my detachment, but another. So they were interviewing people to see who they wanted to pick. So I went over and I got interviewed and I got picked. And we went up there to aggress against the 5th Mech.
How did you do?
We did well. We went up twice, actually. And the first time we went up, and we gave them classes, and they gave us some people to act as guerrillas, and we trained them and told them what we wanted it to do. It was a very good trip. And as I said, Major Hope was an old Germany buddy of my team sergeant. So he's the one that requested the DA team to go up and be, you know, the target for his people. So he knew that... you know, we enjoyed it, and we did our best to, you know, confuse and do whatever we needed to do to win. So, you know.
How much did you use the tactics of the Viet Cong in NVA that you had witnessed over in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. We did a lot of things. One thing is how we won the war. I told you about that. We got one of our indig then to go in and... double agent just to go into the thing. They're raising hell about it, the troops cutting down his trees and stealing his rabbits or something, you know. He finally got in to see Major Hope and opened his coat and said, "You've just been blown up, you know."
Nobody had searched him or thought to search him.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
They were too interested in the fact that, you know, it was his, you know, he was raising enough pain there to make them a little humble, you know, or, you know, back them off a little bit. Plus, these are all Americans, you know. It's not like a little man coming up, you know.
Right.
Little people coming up raising hell.
Right. How long did this last? You said you went up twice.
Yeah, we went up the first time, and then actually went on the field problem the second time. So I guess this is in February, March, somewhere around there. The first part we just was at Fort Devens. And then actually the field portion took part in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And that's when we aggressed against them.
Okay. And when did you get back down to Bragg?
Just before spring starts.
Okay. And when you got back to Bragg, did you know you were going back over eventually to Vietnam, or did you have an opportunity to do something different?
Well, everybody knew that the group would be going. But before that, a lot of us single guys all volunteered to go on another TDY team.
Okay.
And I volunteered, and I went over to B Company. I was in Charlie Company. I went over to B Company and got assigned to a team that was a go team.
Mm-hmm.
And they already had two medics. So the team sergeant told me, he said, hey, look, you know, I got to stick with the man I got. You know, we were both E6s. I outranked the guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, you know, this guy's part of the team already. You know, when the team started, you know, he was part of it.
Right.
So he says, all we can do is keep you as a backup, you know. So the sergeant major in Charlie Company had told us, hey, if you don't like what's going on over there, you always got a home back here in Charlie Company. Mm-hmm. So you just let me know and we'll get you back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. I went ahead and I told the guy, I said, hey, look, you know, if you need me, fine, just let me know. But I'm not going to hang around here as a fifth wheel or, you know, a wallflower waiting when I could be over there doing something that's going to, you know, help me and my team, you know, when we go.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Charlie Company. And that's another quirk of fate. The guy that I outranked and almost replaced got killed over there.
Really?
He's putting out claymores in a rainstorm, and a lightning bolt lit them all off and killed him and some Indige. But
so you went back to Charlie Company.
Yeah.
And you had not gone anywhere. You're back. You're still at Bragg.
Yeah.
You just transitioned back.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, was Charlie Company going to receive orders to go back to Vietnam? Or?
I think then it was pretty well known that Charlie Company was going to go back, and it would be, you know, a stair step type thing. You know, one B team would leave, and then another B team, and then all the A teams under that B team, you know, would leave. And they figured, you know, we'd be leaving around December, so we started pre-mission training then.
Mm-hmm. How much did your training change based on your experience over there?
Well, I think we did a lot more weapons training, variety of weapons, a little more crew serve weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We intensified that. Every man on the team was pretty well versed in A81, and they didn't have. I guess we did do 4.2 deuce training, but everybody on the team got a pretty good handle on crew serve weapons.
Okay.
Patrolling, land navigation, survival, escape and evasion. It was all pretty well covered. But the things we learned in on that TDY tour, not only us, but you know, guys that were in different other parts of the country would kick in some stuff, and we had some pretty good training.
Did it bother you that you were going back into a war zone at all? Or?
No. This is you know, the way things were. You know, that's what you trained for, and that's what you knew was coming anyway.
Mm-hmm. Had your opinion of the war changed any at all? Had it evolved any?
Not really. I never really felt one way or another. You know, it wasn't our job to make excuses for it or to try to defend it or whatever. You know, it was our job. It's just the government had made the decision that these folks were wrong, and we just did our best to minimize it. And I didn't have any pangs of conscience or anything. I didn't feel bad about it.
Mm-hmm. And when did you actually go back? Was it December?
December of 64.
Or we're in 66.
Oh, so, I mean, okay, 64. We went back in the interim. When I went in 66, I went to the 7th group.
Okay.
After you know, I had my time off coming mm-hmm. back in 65.
Mm-hmm.
We went back to the 7th Special Forces group, and this is where we talked about the last time where we went down to Mississippi and.
Okay. This is when you went around doing different training
yeah.
missions.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then this is, I guess, the fall of 1966.
Yeah.
All right.
They looked for they needed a medic to go to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to have a PCS already. You know, mm-hmm. a year's trip already finished, and there were some other things that he needed to qualify. And
mm-hmm.
there's only three guys that raised their hand, and my sergeant major, his nickname was Leather Lungs. So when he saw my hand, he yelled my name, and that was the only thing anybody else heard. So I got the assignment.
Okay. So you went to Okinawa?
Yeah.
And when was this?
In December of 66.
Okay. And how long were you over there?
I stayed over there. I didn't come back from Okinawa until 72.
Okay. So that's where you went in and out of country from there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And when you arrived in Okinawa, what was your assignment? What were you going to do?
I got to B Company.
Uh-huh.
And see, each company had a primary area of interest, and they had a year, at least one problem every year, one field problem every year.
Mm-hmm.
And that B Company had Taiwan, so they were getting ready to go to Taiwan
mm-hmm.
and work with the Chinese Special Forces, the ROC Special Forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got there in time for Christmas and New Year's, and then
mm-hmm.
We started training for Taiwan. And
mm-hmm.
I think we went down there for 3 or 4 months, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And you trained the ROC troops?
Yeah, trained with the Chinese Special Forces, and then...
You mean the Korean?
No, ROC.
Oh, the ROC, okay.
Yeah.
Republic of Korea, or...
Republic of China.
The Taiwanese?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because actually, when you say Taiwanese, we did actually go down and train some. They call them Aborigines, but they're really Taiwanese people.
Okay.
Not the people that came over from the mainland.
Right.
But
what kind of training did you conduct with them?
Pretty much the same, anti-guerrilla, that type of thing. They coordinated their when they had a lot of troops over on Kimoya and Matsuo and the Pescadores.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to get R&R, they'd give them to us.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we had a good bunch of people, and
uh-huh.
you know, it was hard times out there on the islands, being that close to China, and they were bombarding them and stuff. And
mm-hmm.
and we used them as the guerrilla force, and you know, with the Chinese Special Forces.
Okay. And how long did you train them?
This is just, it was more training for us, I guess, than it was for them, because they already belonged to an infantry outfit, you know, and
mm-hmm.
That's all they did on Kimoya and Matsu was,
mm-hmm.
you know, train. But they, you know, they had a lot of amphibious training,
mm-hmm.
for, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. When you finished training them, where did you go? Did you go back to Okinawa?
Back to Oki.
Okay.
Then we started mission training for ourselves again, and then we were getting ready. Our team had been chosen to go to CDY, and we ended up, I think, leaving in June of 67.
Okay.
So.
Where'd you go in June 67?
We went to FOB2 in Kontum.
Mm-hmm.
It's a... There was three FOBs. FOB1 was up north.
Mm-hmm.
FOB2 was in Kontum.
Mm-hmm.
And FOB3, I think, was in Bamituat or somewhere south of there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what'd you do? Did you set up camp there? Or?
Well, actually, we had. They sent four teams over. One went mm-hmm. north, and three went to the Kontum area.
Mm-hmm.
And we were training what they called then hatchet forces. And they were... exploitation forces. When the recon teams would find something, you know, lucrative,
mm-hmm.
They'd weigh the situation and decide whether they you know, bring in air and destroy it, or, you know, send in the exploitation force and, you know, occupy the portion of the terrain and evacuate the stuff or whatever. But they had always, had these exploitation forces, but they never had them, at company-sized units, and that's what they wanted us to do, was to train these company-sized units in tactics as an exploitation slash hatchet force.
These were indigenous forces?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yards, mountain yards. And in the interim, while we were doing this, it was kind of echelons of training. You know, we had two teams in the main camp. We had one team about 6 miles up the road at the yard camp, and they were by themselves. Well, the two teams we had inside the compound at FOB 2, the first team took over, and they had actually had people recruited for them, and they actually had weapons, they actually had clothing and everything where they could just start training right off. And my team, we were next on the list. After these people were all armed and you know, clothed and broken in, then we'd get the priority. Well, in the interim, we would go with the recon teams and supplement, you know, Americans on these recon teams. So that's how we fill the time waiting to get our recruits and get started on training our hatchet force. And then even after we got started training, we still, you know, gave support to the to the recon. They call them spike teams or RTs or STs. One was a 6-man team with two Americans. The other was a 9-man team with 3 Americans.
Okay. What sort of things would you do?
That's strictly recon. Recon, bright light, you know, body recovery, bomb damage assessment. Mostly it's just snoop and poop, or, you know, specialized things. Wiretapping, booby trapping, but most of it was just snoop and poop, go over and find out what's going on.
And you were serving as the medic for this team, is that correct?
Well, actually, we were just recon people. It didn't matter what MOS you were.
Okay.
You didn't function. You know, you were always a medic no matter what you're doing. But they wanted us for reconnaissance. They didn't care what MOS is.
Okay. How comfortable did you feel doing this? This is your third time in country.
Well, I knew that this stuff was going on. You know, I had talked to folks that had been on, because this shady business started in '65, or, you know, got, you know, the scuttlebutt, you know, the rumor control would, you know, talk about things. And we knew what was going on, but we didn't know what was going on to the extent that it was when we got over there. So there was a lot of things happened between '65 and '67.
Why do you think things changed so drastically?
Well, they got the nod from the government, and they actually started, you know, getting people, and I mean, a big operation going. And they had a lot of assets, air assets, and that type of thing to support them. And you know, word spread fast, and they got a lot of new people.
Can you describe some of these operations? Well, you said you did wiretapping, bomb damage control.
Well, we didn't necessarily do it, but it was being done. That was one of the missions. You might be called on to go in for a prisoner snatch, and then you practice and practice, and you go over and you try to snatch somebody and bring them back whole, and you know.
No, would the Americans do the snatching, or would the indigenous do the snatching?
It depends. I've heard stories of guys going out, and one big American just went down and punched the guy in the nose and dragged him off. The guy was so horrified to see this huge American come out. But it's a team effort. You could stun them, you could shoot them, wound them. You could go in after a bomb, you know, an arc light, or, you know, a bombing mission, you know, while they're still stunned. And or just, you know, the old brute force, just jump up, knock them down, and get the cuffs on them, and drag them back, and find an LZ and get out.
Who would do the planning for this?
The 1-0 is the main man. He's the he's in charge of everything. And, you know, like I say, usually the 1-0 and the 1-1 are solid. They stay with each other. They, you know, the end edge, they're it's just like a fist, you know, each one's a finger, you know, and they train together. And the strategy, you know, when they're training, they hear or they read reports of things that worked, people that did it before and how they did it and the planning that went into it, and the fact that, you know, it worked, we'll try it, but we'll change this, you know. Instead of, I'll use a silenced pistol, and you know, I'll shoot him in the thigh, and if he starts yelling or starts shooting, then we'll have to do him in and look for another one, another time. But there's people that went in with crossbows, longbows, several different devices, blowguns. Different, you know, concepts of how, just because they'd make it interesting to come back with a prisoner. There was rewards for it. You know, you got maybe a choice R&R. You know, you go over to Taipei for a weekend or a week, or, you know, something like that. So they made it interesting. And then, of course, you know, there was an old feather in their cap, you know, to be successful. You know, that's, you got bragging rights, you know. But there were in any kinds of numbers of specialized operations, and especially, you know, the guys that were really good, that's the ones that got the, you know, the tapping cables and things like that. And then, of course, you know, the guys that spent the most time on the ground without getting caught were, you know, idolized, and a lot of times you just didn't have a choice. You know, you just you were compromised, and you just got to get out.
What memorable incidents come to mind when you think about that time?
Well, the one I mentioned there, just, you know, getting out of a bomb crater, and the guy I replaced, he's kind of a hard luck dude. He got shot on his first time out with the 1-0, and the second time he got stepped on by an elephant. Actually, an elephant stepped on his foot, and it broke his foot. That's when I took his place to go. And then I got evacuated out because my mom had passed away. But
had you been expecting that? Was she sick, or
No. I was out of clear blue skies and never expected anything like that.
How'd you deal with that and then go back into Vietnam?
Well, it's you know, it's naturally, you know, you lose your mom, you don't expect it, and they're going to live forever, you know. And I think I'd gotten a couple letters about a month before, you know, saying how things were back home and everything was going good. But, yeah, it was a shock. But my concern then was with the team. And because once they told me that I had to get out, the only place they could find was this bomb crater where they could, you know, get a Huey close enough on the hillside. And the fella, the 1-0, actually boosted me up on his shoulders to get up and get a hold of the skid. And like I say, that the 1-0 that I replaced, he was a hard luck kid too, because he went back in with the same 1-0 and got killed. The 1-0 got the Medal of Honor, and the other guy got killed.
You said you were in Laos?
Yeah.
What were you doing? Were you running operations into Laos, or were you operating
We were in Laos.
Okay. You had your camp set up in Laos?
No. Okay. We just fly over in a helicopter and get dropped off and snoop and poop for a while and then come back out.
What they tell you about the path at Lao, the indigenous communist force in Laos?
We really didn't get involved because everywhere we went, it was all NVA. They were all Vietnamese. The path at Lao stayed away from them. Anywhere the NVA were, you wouldn't find any path at Lao.
Why is that?
Well, the NVA didn't want them there. And first of all, and then, you know, the path at Lao, more or less, are, you know, in their centers of population. You know, they're not out worried about what's going on out in the jungle, you know, which, you know, 5 to 15 clicks inside of the border, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did they have a reputation about that Lao being poor fighters, poorly organized? Or
from what I understand, they were, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, again, you know, you've got these, you know, some people are just motivated,
mm-hmm.
and some people were motivated by our people
mm-hmm.
to, for one reason or another, either reward or vengeance or whatever, they, mm-hmm. they fought well. And but as a whole, the straight leg infantry that, you know, the Laotians had was a, it was a not well trained to begin with, and not mm-hmm. well prepared to fight.
Mm-hmm. How would you differentiate between the terrain in Laos and the terrain in Vietnam? Was it basically the same to you, or was it
to me basically the same? Yeah, because you have to understand, except for bomb damage, mm-hmm. These places are pristine. You know, they're really, really untouched. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing. You want to cross a stream, you don't have to worry about broken glass or old.
Mm-hmm.
Cans, you know, and even the recon teams policed up everything. You know, they didn't leave anything, or the ones that did paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people were, you know, they just wouldn't have a bowel movement for 5 or 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
In
order to keep the place clean, or not to give away your position.
Give away your position.
Right.
And you know they. Americans have a, you know, distinct smell. They eat a lot of red meat
mm-hmm.
and drink a lot of beer
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a lot of spice, you know, garlic and that type of thing. People can pick that up. And, of course, if you use soap and deodorants and that kind of crap, then it's another hallmark, you know.
Right. How long would the operations in Laos usually last?
Anywhere from they don't even get off the aircraft to 5 days,
mm-hmm.
or if, you know, you get stuck in by weather or something like that, it might last longer. But I think more or less you prepared for about 5 days stay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there any discussion about whether or not, you know, here's what you do if you get captured. You're in Laos. You're in a supposed neutral country where the United States has publicly said it would not be. Did they talk about this overall political thing at all?
Nah. Chances of you being captured alive were not good,
mm-hmm.
and if you were captured alive, it's the old, you know, don't tell them anything until they put your nuts in a vise.
Right.
And then don't tell them anything, or lie like a son of a gun, and then after 24 hours, tell them anything you want, because it won't matter.
Right.
So, but okay. No, you didn't anticipate anything like that. I don't think. You're prepared for it, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, you never anticipate it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's invulnerable, you know.
Right. What was it more difficult operating in Laos, or was it basically the same as operating?
Well, yeah, because you had no friendlies. You were completely at the whim of these folks.
What about the Royal Lao government forces?
They never entered into the equation because the NVA wouldn't let them near.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they might take some Laotians and use them as, you know, trappers or trail watchers or something like that. But no, they controlled everything there. They owned it.
I was talking about the actual friendlies to the United States who operated near Vientiane and kind of. They weren't really actually in control or really active in Eastern Laos in general.
No.
Okay. How about any of the Montagnard, the Hmong tribes people? Were they? Did you work with them at all?
No.
Okay.
Our people did, but we never used any of them that I know of. They might have had on specific occasions, you know, because remember, if it was a Laotian tracker or
mm-hmm.
You know, a trail watcher or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then he might be the one you want to bring back as a snatch,
mm-hmm.
and they reinsert them fellas, you know. They. I think on one occasion they gave us one guy that I can't remember if he was a snatch victim or whatever, but he was going to be our guide, and they sent the American, his controller, in with us,
mm-hmm.
and they stayed for a couple hours and left. They went back. But yeah, whatever asset you can get, you know, if you had somebody that's been on the ground in a certain area, and you're going back in there. You definitely want to, you know, shrink their head and see you know, what they used, what they found, and, you know, that kind of information is invaluable.
Right. How was your intelligence for these operations?
Pretty good, I guess, as much as they could. You know, the assets that the people in Saigon had were tremendous, you know. And they'd have a, you know, a file on the target, and it just depended on what target it was and what you were looking for within that target. You know, they had a, like a grid zone, you know, and everybody dreaded Hotel 9. That seemed to be the place that nobody really wanted to go into.
Why not?
It was a really hot place, and there was limited areas that you could get in, you know, an LZ. And, of course, they knew that, too, so. But, you know, they circumvented that. You know, they'd put you in somewhere else, you know, or let you walk in. But there were several places in there that were really, really hot. I mean, there was a lot of folks over there. And they didn't want anybody in there because they had a lot of things to hide.
These recon missions, this was on one thing, on the side of what your main task was to train the hatchet forces?
Yes.
Okay. And how much time do you think did you spend running recon missions versus training the exploitation forces?
Well, our main mission was the training of that hatchet force, and that took priority. But see, one person wouldn't stop that training.
Right.
They just, because we had three guys to each platoon, four platoons. So we were doing more good by, you know, going out with a recon team to spell that American, you know, or give them some time off or whatever, or just go with them and add another gun, you know. But it didn't stop what was happening back at the training base.
Right. Now, the hatchet forces, they were South Vietnamese?
They were
Montagnards.
Yeah.
Okay. And what were they like? How different was it working with them versus working with the South Vietnamese?
Well,
they are South Vietnamese technically, but just the difference in the two.
Yeah. Well, there's different tribes, and each tribe has got a different dialect. And we had seven different tribes in our one platoon.
Okay.
So we had an interpreter that spoke French, Montagnard, and Vietnamese.
Okay.
And we used him exclusively. And he could more or less, through, you know, his understanding of the dialect, get over to these other folks. And that was kind of a hindrance there, but luckily we had this one dude that, like I say, could speak French and then a couple of dialects of Montagnard and get it over. And then, of course, once they learn something, you get them hands-on, and that you know, helps the situation out, makes it a little easier.
What kind of tactics were you training these
basic people? Basic infantry tactics, you know, basic weapons, basic fire maneuver. You know, not anything that you wouldn't need in a regular army. You know, act in a helicopter. A lot of these dudes never in an aircraft before.
Right.
Some of them. And different things like that, you know, infiltrating, exfiltrating, rope ladders, strings, getting out in a Maguire rig, you know, tracking, you know, whatever you think you might need to you know, not only keep yourself alive, but you know, complete the mission.
Were you training them to be special forces, or training them to be regular infantry?
Just to be the infantry to the point where they understand the concept of fire and maneuver. They understand what it can do to you and what you can do to the enemy if you do it right. And then how to set up a perimeter, how to fire a claymore, how to use a law. You know, that type of thing. It wasn't anything really grandiose, and it's the type of thing where you train them the basics, and then you're actually training together to work together and to employ the stuff that you're teaching them.
How good were they? How trainable were they?
Well, a lot of these guys, they're professional CIDG. You know, they go from camp to camp, or, mm-hmm. and some of them are just bums. They just go and they sign up and they take the training and say, okay, I ain't going nowhere. See ya. Boom.
Right.
And then they go to another camp, sign up, take 8 weeks of training, get paid, and then go on.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them just took to it, and there was an incident there that, you know, this guy, he ain't stupid. He's in an airplane, and he sees, well, there's his village, you know, and he said, well, I know that elephant trail. That elephant trail go to, you know, we're mm-hmm. not supposed to be here. Mm-hmm. I want to go home.
mm-hmm.
They knew where they were.
Right.
But they didn't know where they were going at the time.
Uh-huh. So how did they react to the Americans? Were they friendly with you? Were they personable?
Mostly yards loved Americans.
Why do you think that was?
Americans are so open, you know, and yeah. They're generous, they're open, and they didn't look down on them. These guys were running around barefoot and with nothing, a little more than a G-string on.
Mm-hmm.
And hunting with crossbows, and they just come out of the caveman era
mm-hmm.
to the modern world, you know.
Right.
And the Americans, they thought, well, you know, these guys will go out with us, and they ain't afraid to go out and shoot it up. And,
mm-hmm.
and it was a mutual respect, and a man's word's a man's word. If this guy says he was your friend, you know, and they pretty much stuck to it.
And this was different than working with the South Vietnamese, the regular Vietnamese population.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Huh. The South Vietnamese, did you find them versus the Montagnards more closed, more suspicious?
Well, I think they were suspicious because there was more. I'm not sure if mendacity is the word,
mm-hmm.
but they knew that why we were there, and they kind of looked down on us because that they were that dependent on another country to come and do their job for them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were fancy dancy. You know, they didn't. You give them a set of fatigues, and the next thing you know, they look more like leotards than they do your fatigues, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They'd have them all hemmed in and zoot suited and that type of thing, you know? And they're more interested in getting their picture taken than, getting the mission done.
So they would actually alterate the clothing you gave them?
Sure, yeah.
Just to look better?
Yeah.
Huh.
Look more dapper, peg pants, And,
uh-huh. And the Montagnards did not do this.
They pretty much, wore the clothing the way it was supposed to be, nice and loose, where you get mm-hmm. a good ventilation and
mm-hmm.
and good protection. Don't mm-hmm. cut the sleeves off because you might need them.
Right.
That type of thing. But they just seem to take more to military life or better than. I think my battery just yelled at me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break just for a sec. This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Martin Brady. Today is August 20th, 2003. It's a little after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Brady, you're in Garland, Texas. Why don't we pick up where we left off, sir? We were talking about your hatchet team training, and could you kind of, going forward from there, what were you involved in, what activities, and then moving toward the beginning of the Tet Offensive?
Well, basically, well, at that time I had went on emergency leave for, I think, 20 days.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back, at the room of control had it that, there was something big in the offing.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much we just continued the training until it became obvious that something was going to happen around Tet.
How could you tell something was going to happen?
Well, the people, more or less the people downtown would be digging foxholes inside the house,
okay.
under their bed and stuff, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And people would be moving, going away or sending their kids off somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That and, the troops themselves were getting a little edgy and they could sense something that was going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we didn't find out about it, but But later on, it was it came out that the NBA and their allies told their people, "Stay the heck away from our camp." They said, "Don't mess with that camp south of the river."
Hmm.
And they said that, you know, everybody's got automatic weapons, and they, you know, it's well determined, well defined, and they got good artillery coverage and all this. So don't mess with them. Go right in. Go for the city.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so basically, they didn't, other than, you know, maybe to cover their movement, you know, drop a couple of rounds in and around the camp. But basically, we could sit on the wall and watch the attack on Khartoum, you know.
Wow.
And it was really awesome, because, you know, I mean, to be sitting there in an easy chair, or, you know, a lawn chair, and watching a battle going on, drinking a Budweiser, you know, is really, really, really crazy.
Was that the first night of Tet?
Yes.
Okay.
And, we kidded around, and they handcuffed one guy to his bed, and they called an alert, and this guy, in his glee to get out and get to his position, he dragged the damn bed with him all the way through the... had to turn it sideways to get through the door.
This is an American?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He wanted to get out and get into the fight?
He wanted to get out and get to where he's supposed to be.
He took his bed with him.
He took his bed with him. Or out the door, through the door, anyway.
Uh-huh. You know. So when...
Yeah, it was... The attack on Khartoum City was something else. It was, you know, like I say, we weren't really involved. We had business of our own. We had teams out that were in trouble, and we really didn't have the assets to get them out.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe what you saw?
Basically, it was a duel between American Air and the NBA anti-aircraft fire. That's mostly what we saw. I guess we were about 3 miles from the city.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you can see the green traces from the bad guys, and our red traces coming from the air, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a team downtown, B-24, I think it was, SFB team, and they took some casualties. And later on, we found out there used to be some little bars we used to go through down there. We call them the Gruesome Threesome, you know, three little beer joints and prostitution, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently they executed a few of the girls because they knew that they were, you know, associating with American.
Hmm.
But that night and I think the next day and then the next night and I think the second day after the stuff started, we were down. We started clearing, and you could actually see where they had, you know, set them up in the wire, and you know, a lot of bodies laying around, and a lot of destruction downtown. Of course, that was, you know, what was happening. Air artillery and ground artillery and the stuff that the NBA had did a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, was our function was just to stay put until we were needed somewhere to go as a reaction force or to bolster some weak spot or whatever, and to stand by that should we need to, you know, go out and rescue some of our folks.
What was your first action?
In Tet?
Yes.
Well, actually, it was just it wasn't really much action at all because it was just mop up, and you know, just. The crew serve weapons in camp naturally supported the people downtown because we had good, you know, good combo with them.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, we didn't really support on the ground as infantry.
Okay. Okay. So when was it that you actually get into the mop-up operations?
I think it was the second day after Tet started. And then it was pretty well decided that they didn't get what they wanted, and they got the runoff. Second or third day, I think.
Did you take the Hatchet teams out, or did you all go out an American SF unit?
No, we went out with our Hatchet force.
Okay.
And I think we had two or three companies went out, and it was just to, you know, to clear the area.
How would you clear the area? What would you do?
Well, basically, just look for any cache they might have, you know, hid or where they buried their dead. You mm-hmm. know, get information off the bodies or mm-hmm. you know, what they carried, and that type of thing. And of course, if we run into any size units, just bring smoke on them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this was in and around Khantoum?
Yes.
Okay. Did you operate in the city much, or
no,
was it mainly out?
It was. I think we remained. Our sector was west of the city. I think. Mm-hmm. I think it was west of the city.
Okay.
And we swept from where we were on the highway.
Mm-hmm.
We swept west of that all the way around to Khantoum and beyond.
Okay. How long did you perform these sweeps?
I think it was 2 or 3 days, off and on.
Mm-hmm. And after you finished these, what did you do? What did your unit do?
Well, we had casualties coming in because mm-hmm. we had a pretty decent dispensary there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had casualties coming in from, I think it was the 4th Infantry Division. They got a bunch of people burned up. So we doubled as medics in the mm-hmm. dispensary helping them with people. But, yeah, we had some American casualties coming in. And, you know, also, you know, the casualties that we incurred, you know, from our people going, we had, I think it was 7 teams across the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have the air assets to get them all out.
Mm-hmm.
And several of them were in a tight situation.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we lost one of our people on the 29th of December. And he was being extracted. And he either fell out or was pulled out of the strings. They were coming out on the McGuire rig. And the first American and 3 little people came out. And then the 1-0, the team leader, and 2 or 3 other little people were coming out. And he either slipped out or got knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
While coming through the trees, and he was MIA for years.
Mm-hmm.
And
were the remains found?
No, they sent in a bright light team. A few days later, they found out where he had fell through the canopy, and they seen where the NVA had come in and sterilized the area.
Mm-hmm.
But they figured that with the jungle canopy that they had. That and the weight, this is a huge man. He's about 6'4", 6'6",
mm-hmm.
and, you know, pretty near 300 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
He's a huge man. And he's also a medic. They figured that the foliage was probably enough to break his fall where he wouldn't have been killed.
Because
mm-hmm. they had no idea how high he was when he, you know, when he slipped out of the rig or fell. And he was the only casualty KIA, or missing,
mm-hmm.
that we incurred in that area. We lost another guy up at the FOB up north, up
mm-hmm.
by Fubai.
Mm-hmm.
And he was killed. They recovered the body. But
okay.
Charlie White, they never recovered.
Okay. Did you know Charlie well?
Yeah, I knew him pretty well. He was a medic, I was a medic. And I had gone out a couple times with the folks from the yard camp. They were up in the yard camp. It's about 6 miles from where we were in the actual FOB2.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You were getting ready to be leaving country soon. You left in February.
Yeah.
And did you know your date you were leaving? Or
no, not really. It was an open date.
Uh-huh.
You know, because they didn't really. Our people on Okinawa, you know, didn't want to yank us and leave those people over there,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a bind. If they needed us, we'd stay. They could always extend us.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much by the time we left, everything, you know, the tent was well over.
Right.
Everything was going on. And
right.
The teams that were coming in to relieve us were in processing. So.
Okay. So you went back to Okinawa?
Yes.
Okay, and you were based there at Okinawa, correct, the entire time until 1972?
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask, I don't know if we covered this before, but why did you get the emergency leave, the 20-day emergency leave?
My mother passed away.
Okay.
I think we talked about it.
Yes, sir. I thought that's what had happened.
Yeah.
Okay. How were you doing personally coming back in country after such something like that happens?
Oh, it was crazy. You know, I try to explain to the family, you know, coming out of a bomb crater in Laos and being home within, actually leaving that bomb crater, getting boosted into the chopper, and actually being at the funeral parlor
mm-hmm.
where my mom was waked. And, you know, it was just within 48 hours.
Wow.
And it's just, you know, just going from that atmosphere to the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, seeing all the family and everything.
Mm-hmm. And what about when you came back? What kind of mindset did you have?
Oh, man. The same dude that got handcuffed to the bed, he looked there, and, you know, everybody had a buzz on, drinking beer.
Right.
And it was, you know, a weekend. And I walked in. He says, you're crazy. What the hell are you doing here? He says, you were gone. He says, you were clear. You were free. You know, what the hell's the matter with you? He says, you're crazy, Brady. What the hell's the matter with you?
He thought you were going to take off.
Yeah, well, he said if I had a brain in my head, I would have. You know? He says, I thought I raised you better, you dumbass. You know, what the hell did you come back for? You know, you could have stayed on Oki. And could, he says, we're all going to be killed. You know, they're going to attack the camp. And you know, of course, he's ragging me is what he's
mm-hmm.
doing.
Right. So when you got back to Okinawa, what did you do?
Pretty much the same thing we always did, training, mm-hmm. and get ready to do something else. And we had, I think, right after I got there, I think we went into rough terrain jumping.
Mm-hmm.
And ordinarily they send you down to Taiwan for their rough terrain school and jump with the Chinese, but mm-hmm. They couldn't afford that. So my team sergeant, Woody Woodworth,
mm-hmm.
Devised a way that we could do the training on Oki.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just instead of jumping in Taiwan, which we did eventually anyway, but we could jump in the northern end of Okinawa, which is pretty well, you know, pretty much
yes.
Tree covered and hilly mm-hmm. and enough rough terrain to get us, you know, the experience of jumping in the jungle or forest or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like every time you were extracted from Vietnam, you just continued to train and train and train.
Oh, yeah, that's for 20 years. You just continue to, you know, sharpen, you know, or, you know, hone your skills. And
mm-hmm.
And that counts as medical, too, because they sent us up to Cooey Hospital for mm-hmm. To work on a ward. And I might have told you about this, but before we went down, they had this staff sergeant was in there, and he'd been shot up pretty bad and had a chunk of his ass ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
What had happened is they were in recon, and they were counting this NVA unit as they went by them,
mm-hmm.
and they got caught, and the NVA opened up on them, and the one guy, the last guy in the tail gunner, the NVA, either stepped on this guy or came across him anyway. And that was it. And, you know, they got a big firefight and all this.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently the NVA didn't like Americans because he was going to try and shoot this guy's testicles off.
Mm.
So he tried to, you know, on automatic, he tried to burn him.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy had... he was medevac back to Okinawa, and he was on the ward up there when we were, you know, on this, they call it cross training, but it's not cross training. It's, you know, just getting you back into a medical environment to see how things are done, mm-hmm. you know, in an ideal situation.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I was talking to him, and he says he'd never forget it. You know, the guy just, you know, he's just trying to, you know, cause as much damage to his genital areas as he could.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a lot of damage. Poor guy was really, really tore up.
Mm.
But, yeah, he told some stories about, you know, running recon and
mm-hmm.
Things they found, tactics they used and stuff like that. But, yeah, we did cross-training. We cross-trained our other people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of maritime stuff, rubber boat training, swimming, long-distance swimming, scout swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Things of that nature.
And this went on all the way until June of the next year when you went back?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you feel like when you came back from Vietnam and you went through all this training, did you feel that you were getting better and better and better at your job, or was it something that was just very, very tiresome and it was draining you?
Well, some of it was, you know, kind of boring. Mm-hmm. But you knew that the more you did things, the more you trained, and got away from it. You know, you get rusty at anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you do something, then the easier it is to get back in the saddle, get back in harness. You know.
Yes.
That reaction drills and you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Things you. When we went back in 69, they had what they called the COC course, the Combat Orientation Course.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a week or 10 days that they put you back into a combat environment out on Hontre Island.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you walk around with a rucksack full of sand, 75 pounds of sand. And, you know, you do long marches, night marches, land navigation, weapons firing, automatic reaction drills, things of that nature, and it hones your skills, and you learn things that you know you might do, you know, as a mistake, you know, not taking your safety off, or you know, not having a round in the chamber, and you know, or you're not keeping a round in the chamber, and the weapon gets dirty, you know, at least you can fire it, you know, and clear some of that crap out of it, you know, and. That type of thing, but yeah, it's some of it's, you know, kind of mundane. But the more you do it, the better you're going to be at it when that skill is needed. You know?
Mm-hmm. Who actually was doing the training?
It was special forces people that were assigned there to Hontre.
Okay.
And remember, at this time here, the people were rotated, you know, out of A camps and sent back to a higher headquarters or to a another camp that wasn't so hot, or you know. More toward the rear or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew most of the guys that were training us, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody's got a reputation one way or another. You know these guys, that they've been there and they know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my next question. How much did you take your experiences in country back to Okinawa and really use them, help others, train others, talk about, hey, this is what happened on this operation, have you ever seen this? Did you share information like that?
Oh, sure, yeah. Because, like I say, when you get back, you might not stay on that detachment. You move to another one, or you might go to another company, or you might, you know, depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you always relay, you know, especially to the younger guys, they're always curious, you know.
Right.
And, you know, like I say, it's an ongoing thing, cross-training.
Mm-hmm.
Primary, you know, training in your MLS.
Did you have a lot of unit integrity? Were you able to keep the men together?
Yeah, even today. In fact, last night, I was on the phone until about 11 o'clock last night talking to my senior medic in 1963.
Really?
And he's still at, right outside of Fort Bragg there in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, we had a reunion in Houston in 2000. We had a reunion at Fort Bragg in 2002, and that's just one team, you know.
Right.
From 1963,
mm-hmm.
and except for the team sergeant, I think me and him were the only two that served on the team again together.
Right.
And we knew each other so well. You know, you pick up a phone. There's no need for an exchange of names. You know the voice.
Mm-hmm.
The way people walk, the way they walk at night, habits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot of team integrity and a lot of genuine friendships, you know, grew out of, you know, a team assignment.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, Kipfer was my senior medic in 63. When we got back in January of 64, he got orders to Oki and went over, and then he went from Oki, he went TDY to the Delta Project in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him, he was still there in 65 when correction, 64, in December of 64 when we got over there. He was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Because we ran into him at the airport, me and Stuart.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever experience any race issues? Did you see this at all?
I guess you do to a point, you know. Everybody's got a little racist in them, or maybe not racist, but say a prejudice or a bias, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, the non-Caucasian members of the teams and special forces were so good that I don't see where anybody really had a prejudice or a. The black guys we had were, I mean, great. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, they were as sincere and as dedicated as anybody on the team. The mm-hmm. the Oriental Americans the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then you get a dud, but you know they get weeded out.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't think so. But you know, other than you know, some of these guys were born and raised in rural Mississippi and Alabama and
right.
Georgia, and, you know, and they were raised. And these guys got along probably better with black people than people of color than guys from New York or you know New Jersey or Cleveland or you know Detroit.
You're talking about the white guys born in the South.
Yeah,
got along better with the black guys that are born in the South.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you know it's not all you know it's not always that way, but
mm-hmm.
And you would think it'd be harder for them to you know to get along, but it didn't work that way. It seemed to work well. And like I say, the guys we had were as well trained and as eager and anxious to get the job done. And,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is the basic, and it's not just race or religion or nationality. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's just you know some people just don't like people.
Right.
We had a few of those that you know they just didn't like anybody.
What do you do with those guys?
Nothing, as long as they do their job.
Yeah.
You know, as long as they can. As they say in the infantry, you know, close with, kill, capture, or destroy the enemy, and deny him key terrain features.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they can do that, they got a job.
Right. When you're back on Okinawa, how much were you able to keep up with what was happening back in the United States? And for that matter, when you were in country, were you able to do that?
Well, mostly it was, the only time I really remember keeping tabs on things is when Kent State happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was up in the city getting reenlisted when that happened,
mm-hmm.
and they had a sign in the beer joint there, Kent State 0, National Guard 3 or something, you know.
Jeez.
And most of the information I got was Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, guys talking and that type of thing. You know, AFRTS. You know, if it was available.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, I got mail from home, and they kept mm-hmm. me abreast of things.
How much did you write home? How much did they write you?
I didn't write very much, but I got a lot of. I had we had a large family, six girls and four boys.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a lot of. And, of course, they all had kids, and the kids would write, you know.
Right.
Sent a few care packages and things like that.
Now, why didn't you write a lot?
I really, I started sending some tape messages back to my dad
mm-hmm.
after my mom died. And I got hung up on that. And then, you know, I'd write him a letter maybe once every couple of months or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
To me, writing is a chore, you know. To this day, I hate to write letters. You know, if I can get a weasel out with a card or something, I'll
mm-hmm.
do that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just did it to let them know that I was still okay. Because most of the guys in SF, that you know, should they get wounded or anything like that, they don't send the message home anyway. You know?
Right. Did you tell your family members or those whom you were writing? When you did write about what you were doing, the stuff that you could tell, or did
protect
them?
No, I told them pretty much. You know, that, as an overall picture, you know, not individual accounts of things. You know, just that, you know, what we were about and how often we did what we did, and
mm-hmm.
this and that. But no, not really. Unless they ask some, the FBI that we got. We had interim top secret clearances.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI went around checking the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, the neighbors, you know, called home to my parents. And said, hey, the FBI was here checking on Marty. He's in Vietnam, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
okay.
Here's the FBI telling them where the hell their son is. You know?
Right.
They didn't know it.
Because,
you know, you could take the letters, the guys go rotating back, you know, and they can send them from Okinawa or in the States, you know, stateside, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're going back there.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever able to make any Mars phone calls?
I made one Mars phone call, and that was from the Marshall Islands.
Hmm.
And I was also the medic, and I was also the radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a hold of I think he's the guy in, he's either in Saipan or Kwajalein, I guess it was,
mm-hmm.
at a Mars station there in Kwaj. And he got me through to my dad in New York.
Hmm.
And I think that's the only time I ever used Mars.
When was that? Do you remember?
That was in 71, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, 71. I was down there 6 months with an engineer team.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me what you all would do as a unit for entertainment, I guess, in country and at Okinawa.
Oh, pretty much, you know, everybody's got a favorite little joint to mm-hmm. get down to, because it's, you know, getting back into the reality again. You know, they might be Vietnamese or Cambodian or Laotian or mm-hmm. whatever, but they're people, you know, and things go on, and you get out and drink a couple of beers and then come back to camp or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you guys pretty much hang to yourselves, this SF guys?
Well, you know, if you got along well with the LLDB,
mm-hmm.
you could, you know, get your counterpart and say, come on, let's go have a beer, you know,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. And, you know, you usually pal up with somebody on the team, because you know, we used to go on scrounging runs for food.
Mm-hmm.
So any American unit that was in the area, you'd go over there and, you know, trade stuff and con them out of some, you know, fresh meat or
mm-hmm.
whatever, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you always went in pairs. And, of course, when you get, you know, 5 days, usually about every 3 months, 2 or 3 months, to go to town
mm-hmm.
and blow off steam and go down to Tudor Street.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, usually the guy that you go on R&R with is, you know, your buddy, and, you know, you usually pound around.
Mm-hmm. What about drug and alcohol use?
Alcohol, yeah. Some guys wouldn't touch it. Some guys wouldn't touch it on site. But, you know, they'd drink all they wanted, you know, at the B team or the C team.
Mm-hmm.
And other guys just stayed drunk. They just drank all day, you
mm-hmm.
know. You don't drink beer for breakfast, but it's better to drink Coke and beer than it is to drink water, unless it's, you know, like boiled tea or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs as, you know, as a recreational use, no. I don't recall anybody on any team that I was ever with that messed with pills or
mm-hmm.
or injection or now the Vietnamese and the Yards and the Cambos
mm-hmm.
have what they call Thuc Lao,
mm-hmm.
and this I think is their pot,
mm-hmm.
or Chad or, you know, whatever it is, but they smoke it,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's like passing a peace pipe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you that, I would say, would be the closest thing to indulging in drugs. The Vietnamese got a homemade whiskey called Ba Si Dai.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to the beer joints and you get a little jigger, well, it's a big jigger of Ba Si Dai for, you know, a couple of pennies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you light it up and you buy a dried squid. And you run the squid over until it burns the outer skin, and you can peel it off, and you eat the squid with the Ba Si Dai.
Hmm.
But when you're with the troops, they don't make that much money. And if you, as an American, go around buying beer, drinking beer, this guy can't buy you back.
Right.
So if you go down and you get a, you know, a 5 piaster shot of hooch, you know, and eat a dried squid or a dried fish or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you're in his league. Then you're not, you know, putting any burden on him because
right.
he could buy back, you know.
Right. Right. What role did music play for you over there? Did you all have the radio from time to time?
Not really. As a kid in New York, believe it or not, they had the Midwestern Jamboree or something like that. One came out of Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
and Louisiana Hayride was one. And then there was another one that we'd get up in New York. And I got introduced to Hank Williams at an early age,
mm-hmm.
and I loved Hank Williams. So mm-hmm. naturally, most of the SF guys were country and western fans, although, you know, guys were really highbrow opera and mm-hmm. classical, and, you know, had a really diverse palette, you know. And American music, I think I lost about 10 years from 66 to 72. I think I never really got involved
mm-hmm.
other than recordings, you know, of old music.
Mm-hmm.
All these rock bands and the Who and the Kiss and the whatevers, I never heard them, never cared much for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really caught on to it. And you know, to this day, I don't really care for that kind of music.
Are there any songs that you hear today that take you back to Vietnam?
Oh, sure. That the soundtrack from Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
That's you know, that really can get you going.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, a lot of the country and western music I remember because when we went to build that camp in Tuyen in 64, mm-hmm. went over and we stayed with this TDY team from Okinawa for 2 months,
mm-hmm.
or 3 months, and they had access to all these reel-to-reel tapes from Oki, and this guy had the best collection of country and western music I've ever seen in my life. He had about 50 tapes,
mm-hmm.
and it went all the way back to the 20s and 30s, all the way up through Johnny Cash,
and wow.
Waylon Jennings, and Merle Haggard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he left a lot of that stuff with our people too. So.
Right. Did you ever go to any USO shows?
The closest thing we ever got to a USO in Loc Ninh, which was my last assignment there, Martha Ray signed the bunker.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But in that same camp at Loc Ninh at Christmas time, an Air Force caribou flew in. And had Santa Claus painted on the nose of the caribou,
mm-hmm.
and they had some genuine American type women.
Okay.
Cold beer and cigarettes, and cigars and stuff. And they landed and spent about 15 minutes, had a good talk and some beer, and gave us some presents. And then they took off for another camp because we had three camps in that area: Loc Ninh, Boot Up, and Tonglishan.
Mm-hmm.
They were all into B-33 at. Han Quan.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was the closest thing I was scheduled to go to Australia for R&R.
Right.
And I was scheduled to go to Bangkok for R&R.
Mm-hmm.
But I get to Saigon and you run into your old cronies in Saigon and say, ah, the hell with it. I didn't lose anything in Australia, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I never did go out of country. I did one time. I went back to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
The club would have their chit books
mm-hmm.
made, printed on Okinawa. And because that way there, you know, it wouldn't be duplicated or, you know, copied, you know, in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a local printer.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, you had to go, took a turn going back to Okinawa to bring back all these printed up chit books and other stuff. You know, from Okinawa back to Nam. So you got a couple of days
mm-hmm.
to visit, and that was, you know, like an R&R. I think I had 5 days on Oki.
Right. Were your religious beliefs at all affected by what you experienced in Southeast Asia?
No, not really. I don't think. When we went over in '63, we stayed in a camp that we called him a warlord, but it was one of the Catholic priests
mm-hmm.
that had come south after the they sliced the country in half, and they brought down a bunch of Chinese and Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
from the north and resettled them down in the Delta. And the guy we had was living in the camp, and he had his house and a church was inside the camp.
Mm-hmm.
There was even a little convent with nuns, a few nuns that taught school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was Roman Catholic, but on all our dog tags, for religion, it put no preference, or most of the guys put TAC Air.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really want the priest to know what religion, because he would definitely use that as a, have the advantage on you.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we had several Catholics on the team. And but, as far as the killing and maiming and,
mm-hmm.
like I say, it not really. I can't recall ever, blaming God or seeking forgiveness. It didn't seem necessary.
Okay. So tell me what you did when you went back in June 69. What was your mission then?
Pretty much A-team assignment again. That's what I wanted. What had happened is a good friend had chose not to go to language school.
Mm-hmm.
And they offered a course in Vietnamese, a 3-month course in Vietnamese. So one guy didn't, he wanted to go get his tour over with, so he just went directly to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And three or four of us went to the Vietnamese language school just to get back to the States and, see what the heck's going on,
Hmm. When was this?
This was in 69.
Okay.
We went to the Crowell Collier Institute, which is in Alexandria, I think, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all, civilian clothes, nice, female instructors, all varieties of women,
mm-hmm.
Orientals, Arabs, whatever language, or whatever nationality taught there at the school. They had women and men teachers. But
this is prior to June 69 when...
Yeah.
Okay.
We would, I think it was March, April, and May, something like that.
Mm-hmm. How did you do at the school, academically?
I did pretty good because I could speak it, I could
mm-hmm.
Converse, And when you go to these language schools, they want you to talk like a lawyer or a doctor,
Mm-hmm.
And you don't run into people like that.
Right.
You go rapping like a doctor, and who's this rube,
Mm-hmm.
So we melted them down as quickly as we could. And, come on, we want to know how you talk to a farmer,
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to polite stuff. We want to know how to tell a guy to sit down or you're going to break his legs, Or,
mm-hmm.
But of course you want to learn it, to tell him to sit down politely too. But,
right.
You need to know the difference.
Right. Were you able to obtain that information?
Oh, yeah, we did pretty well. In okay. fact, we had Dr. Cho was a Korean instructor. We
mm-hmm.
went to 3 months of Korean later on when I got back to Bragg. And, she would not, you had to call her Song Sang Nim, which is, something equivalent to exalted teacher,
Mm-hmm.
And she just, we had some base dudes in that team. And, she'd just leave the classroom bawling her head off, and she had to go up and see Mr. Malak. He was the head of the language school there at Fort Bragg,
mm-hmm.
a Saudi Arabian native. And he'd come down, he'd say, okay, who did it, what'd you do? And the woman, you just can't live with her. She won't, she just thinks we're going over there to exist in the city and talk to some lawyer or some doctor or
mm-hmm.
some, college professor, and that's not what we're here for. We're here to learn the language of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the time we left that school, she would not let us speak English. We spoke all in Korean, read all in Korean, and she taught us. We had what they call it. It was a special day they have. Culture
mm-hmm.
time or culture hour or day, whatever the heck it was. When we graduated there, she bought us a case of beer, and it was such a change, after. She understood then what we were talking about and where we were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And she melted. She did us some good. But even in Crowell Collier, that was mostly ASA and that type of folks were going to school, and they were all, you know, college graduates, most of them, you know, young kids. They had, you know, a couple old grizzled dudes like us. But we told the guy, and the guy knew we were genuine, and we'd put, you know, two or three tours in them before we went to that course. And they kind of acquiesced and did it our way.
Were you learning Vietnamese or Korean?
In 69, it was Vietnamese. But
okay.
I had gone to a Vietnamese course before that in 63, and it was just, you know, survival stuff, you know. But usually if I go to another country, the first thing I do is, you know, learn the basics, you know, count, and, you know, normal exchange of, you know, niceties or whatever. And, of course, you know, all this time, too, while you're doing mission training, you're also, you have what they call area study. You're relegated a point in the world that you're going to be responsible for. Should something happen that they need a team. So you do all this background, you know, the history and the culture and the language and all this stuff. So you might be training to go to Africa, and but your area study is, you know, somewhere in Korea.
What was your area study?
I think one was right outside of North. Was it right on the border of Harbin, China? I think it was. It's right on the other side of the North Korean border. That was one. It's been so long, but you know it could be anywhere.
Do the special forces still employ this thing?
Oh sure. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you went back in June 69, back into Vietnam, you were, I guess, very prepared.
That's where I was leading when I got
yeah, right.
Off there. Yeah. Well, this guy that didn't go to language school, he was over there in country already. He had already gone through the COC course, was already down to the team. I think I might have told you the story. Cut me off.
Go ahead.
He sent me a letter on when I was in language school. He says, oh, you know, come on over. You know, I know you're coming to Vietnam. He says, oh, you need to come down where I'm at. Got a nice camp, you know, with a big runway. A French guy's got a swimming pool down the end of the runway. And, yeah, you need to come over here. It's real nice. Nice, calm camp, you know. So I said, okay. So I got over to the country, you know. I fly over that sucker in the Milk Run chopper. And holy criminy, they had bunkers, and, you know, out in the rubber. And the holes in the PSP on the runway. And the Frenchman's house is all tore up. There's no water in the pool. Trees in the pool. And, wrecked 123 or a wrecked 130 down in the end of the runway. I said, holy heck. So I said, okay. So I ended up getting to the camp. Well, I wrote this other guy. I said, hey, me and Lee's over here at this camp. You know, it's real nice. Got a nice runway. Frenchman's got a pool at the end of the runway. You know, it's real quiet. You'll like it, you know. So he came. So we fished him into it. And he wrote back to this other guy, Turcotte, hey, nice camp, you know, good runway, you know, all this. Frenchman's got a pool at the end of the runway. You ought to come down. Well, he got short-stopped because he had one leg. He got shot up in the Mike Force, and he had one leg was shorter than the other, so the Sergeant Major put him back in the Mike Force, wouldn't let him go out to the camp. So, but that was the hello I got when I got to camp.
Okay. Where were you located?
It was in... Three Corps, three CTZ. Locked in was, have you heard of the parrot speak?
Oh, yes.
Okay. That locked in was just directly south of the parrot speak. And, and it was just north of Hong Kong on Highway 13, bloody Highway 13.
And you were there for 1 year?
Yeah.
What kind of operations did you run out of there?
Mostly ambush, interdiction, border surveillance, sweeps, a lot of hellebore assaults. We got a lot of, because the 11th ACR, 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, was right outside our gate. Well, one squadron of it, anyway. And Charlie liked to drop rounds on them, and they drop rounds on us. And of course, they had tanks and APCs. And we'd supply little people as infantry for their APCs and tanks. So it's strange. strange to be a, you know, a staff sergeant, or no, actually I was E7 then, I guess, sergeant first class with a platoon of tanks opcon to me. You know, it's a strange war.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty testy camp to get. In fact, we used to make a run down to Anquan to buy a beer,
mm-hmm.
and we'd take the money that we'd sell the beer back to us as a club.
Mm-hmm.
If we bought it for 12 cents a can, we'd sell it, you know, back to us for 15 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd take the money and we'd buy, you know, something we could use in the camp. And if you lasted 3 months without getting medevac, we'd buy each other a watch.
Okay.
So we drank a lot of beer, made a lot of money. So
mm-hmm.
We ended up buying Rolexes out of the PX. They were $175 a piece.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up buying the guys that didn't get medevac Rolexes by the time they left.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we also sold the beer to the Indig, you know, because for them it was kind of a prestige thing, you know. They'd come in and buy canned beer and take it home, you know, and
mm-hmm.
show off. Of course, you know, there's a good percentage of yards and camboats in our camp.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did you work mainly with Americans, or was it mixed? Did you mix or work with the Montagnards?
Mostly, at Locked In, we had mostly camboats.
Okay.
We had what they call the KKK, the Khmer Sarai, and most of those guys were good soldiers. They were really good,
mm-hmm.
and most of them were being trained to move back into Cambodia and to take Cambodia over, which they did eventually
mm-hmm.
while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And they took a lot of people out of our camp to be the leadership
mm-hmm.
of the when La Nola, I guess. Had that fiasco mm-hmm. going on. But, we had four companies of Cambod Yards and one Vietnamese company.
Okay. Can you describe what you all would do each day? What was your typical day like and your missions?
Well, usually the LLDB would pretty much try to pick the targets, and then, you know, you got to, you know, do a little finagling there if you wanted to. You know, certain areas they didn't want to go in, and that's the areas we wanted to go in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, most of the time they'd either compromise or, you know, okay, we'll go there, but we won't go all the way there. We'll just, you know, go around there. And, of course, if you hit pay dirt, then, you know, you get some more assets, you know, from the first air cab was in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot of air assets that we could call on, gunships or, you know, slicks or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, setting your mind where you were going, what you wanted to accomplish, and how you were going to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And people have pet ways of doing things, you know. Some guys like to take extra mortars with them, you know, 60-millimeter mortars, just have their own little artillery, you know. And laws, you know, light anti-tank weapons, you know, for use against bunkers and stuff. And then, of course, the Indies, you know, a lot of them like to use the communist weapons. You know, that RPG is a good weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you know, you can go ahead and get resupplied out in the field from whoever you take on, you know.
Mm-hmm. Describe how you would operate. What did you prefer to take with you, and how would you operate out in the field?
Well, most of the time it was two Americans, and
mm-hmm.
usually, you know, me being a medic, there would probably be a weapons man or a commo man or,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And and depending on, you know, how what you had planned to do, how big a force you'd have with you, you could go out, you know, with a recon platoon for ambushes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might have two companies with you.
Okay.
You know, a company I think was about 100 men, 120 men, something
mm-hmm.
like that. But I just carried what Sam issued most of the time, the M16 at Locked In. I always carried an M16 and about 25 magazines, some frag grenades, and then smoke and Willie Peter,
mm-hmm.
one Willie Peter, and a couple of smoke. and a lot of water. I always had 4 quarts of water with me.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at that time they had PIR rations, you know, for the little people.
Mm-hmm.
And mutton was one menu. Shrimp and mushroom was another. And these little fishies, you know, little dried fish.
Mm-hmm.
That was another menu. So we ate usually what the little people ate. And, of course, if they kill a snake or a rat or something, you know, they throw it on the fire.
Mm-hmm.
It's another source of protein.
How long would you stay out?
Ordinarily, it was about 5 days, unless something happened, and you know, you had to move a long, larger distance or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But normally about 5 days to a week. That was the normal operation.
Okay. Can you describe some of the contact you had?
A lot of times, you know, you're always wary of, you know, because the place belongs to Charlie,
mm-hmm.
and you're just visiting.
Mm-hmm.
So you're pretty much aware of what the heck's going on, but every now and then you'd hit on a target of opportunity, and it just depends on who is in this strategic position and who's got the, you know, the mass ass, you know, the
mm-hmm.
higher power and the ability to maneuver. And most of the time it was we were in charge, you know. So luckily that way we never really, a couple of times we were threatened with possible, you know, being overrun.
Mm-hmm.
Not very often. We usually had the upper hand. And I think it was the 7th NVA division that the folks that we were mainly up against. You know, they had other smaller units, regiments and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that in the area. But any large contact, I don't think we ever had anything larger than probably a company.
Okay.
That I personally, now we've had guys run into a unit larger than the company. And, you know, you bring in air assets, and, you know, mostly it's, you know, it's targets of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And
would you hit them or would you call in air on them?
Well, first of all, you know, it's the initial contact. We had that, what they call a tambao, is the recon platoon, and that would be our point.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had points on either side. So as you're moving through the area, going to an objective, the objective being the area that you want to scope out or, you know, check out, or you might have an agent report or something that, you know, there's a cache there or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be a bivouac area.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these really small villages on the periphery of, you know, civilization, you know, hell, Charlie owned them, you know. He could spend his night there, and, you know, they might be his house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you try to get there first light, you know, and before you get a chance to, you know, to leave. And like I say, if he's running his operation there, and you know he knows he's safe there, and it's reasonably secure hiding from the air, you know, that he's not going to be found out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's chance encounters. I remember we were we were sitting there taking a break, and this guy walked right into the perimeter. Because, you know, some of the guys were taking cat naps and
mm-hmm.
ranger naps. This guy just waltzed into the damn perimeter. Well, all of a sudden, this guy behind me
mm-hmm.
decides he's going to wax him. He opens up on him and mm-hmm. kills him dead about 10 feet from where we're sitting.
Mm-hmm.
But that happened 2 or 3 times the same day.
Wow.
These guys just didn't believe that there was anybody there. You know, and of course they didn't get that deep into the perimeter, but
mm-hmm.
you know, they were, you know, well clothed, well equipped, and they, you know, all of Cambodia in that area was a sanctuary for the
mm-hmm.
NVA. So, you know,
right. Did you ever employ snipers?
We had one starlight scope in the camp,
mm-hmm.
and I used to get the starlight scope at night, and they used to come and steal gas, and I used to pop a couple of rounds over their heads when they go to steal gas. And they wouldn't, you know, steal a gallon. They'd steal a whole 55-gallon drum or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they knew you were watching them, then they'd slack it off. But yeah, we had sniper trained personnel, but actually performing a sniper mission, I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the recon people, I'm sure did. You know, on but you know. I guess you could call it an ambush patrol is you know, almost like sniping.
Right.
You know, if you're trying to grab somebody.
How often were you able to capture an enemy?
Sometimes business was good, sometimes not so good. I think the harder core NVA were tougher to take prisoner. I think the local militia and the local people that you know, you're not really, you know, all you can do is, you know, suppose that he's the enemy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were harder to capture than they were to kill. And
okay.
Like I say, if you make contact, you gotta make a decision. Do I need air? Do I need artillery? What do I need? What are my assets? What do I want to do? And I remember one time we were out and we run into the lead element of it was the headquarters for this element of the 7th NVA Division. And at that time, our tactics were if you made contact, everybody in that area would open up and at least burn one magazine. Well, this point man saw the formation coming.
Mm-hmm.
Gave the hand signal to the guys behind him, opened up with one magazine,
mm-hmm.
left, and then these guys opened up. And holy Anthony, the whole world opened up. Well, then they started opening up, and we got the first guy that the initial NVA that got killed at their point, man. We got his body and got the stuff off of him, and then they regrouped and started to counter us.
Mm-hmm.
So we called in air. We got some slow movers, A1Es, and they come in and dropped a bunch of stuff. And then I think we got some fast movers in with CBU cluster bomb units.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the gunships.
Right.
But we had slow movers, fast movers, and helicopters come in and support. And they liked what they saw because it was a turkey shoot.
Mm-hmm. Which was the most effective? To call in?
I would say probably the guns.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had the miniguns and, it looked like a plowed field when they got finished.
Mm-hmm.
But the CBU and the miniguns, but, you know, it's just the knowledge that they know that these fast movers come in with napalm and it's just awesome. It's just an awesome weapon. And, they know they've been had. You know, if they stick around, they're going to get waxed. And with that much air, God, you know, the man has to be insane. You know,
mm-hmm.
He's either going to get on your lap or get the hell out of Dodge. You
mm-hmm.
know, that's the only way he's going to get away from the air.
Right.
And but yeah, it was awesome. It was. But that awakening I got at Loch Ninh is that. I got in the one day and I left for the field the next day.
Hmm.
Come back from the field, they rocketed the hell out of us, blew my room up.
Hmm.
They had 107 rockets, and,
mm-hmm.
and they were smart because they had delays on them. You know, they'd get down because we were all underground. The whole camp was underground except for we had a tower, a water tower, and the tops of the bunkers were used for. We used to show movies to the troops. We'd get movies in and we'd watch them ourselves. The Campos were crazy about American Westerns. They loved cowboy movies.
Uh-huh.
And that would be on top of a bunker. And the camp itself was, a perimeter, but we also had an inner perimeter where the Americans and the LLDB stayed.
Mm-hmm.
and of course, you know, the combo bunker and all the most of the mortar bunkers that we fired. We had, I think, one or two 4-deuce pits and several 81 millimeter mortar pits, and you know, all kinds of fighting positions. And mm-hmm. stuff.
Very well defended.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Did you ever work with any canine units?
We had one at Loch Nin. The guy, they brought him with to it was OpCon to the first Cav, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we never used. We had several guys brought their dogs. With Roland Marquis brought his dog when we went to Khantoum in '67
mm-hmm.
from Oki. In fact, they printed a phony set of orders, so the Air Force. You know, would let her on the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Down at the American Legion, they had like a Xerox machine. So we got orders printed up for Kiuna Haida, canine.
Mm-hmm.
And she was great. She German Shepherd.
Yeah. How did you use her?
Well, we just had her for a pet.
Just had her around.
Yeah.
Okay.
But she knew everybody. At night, she'd come in and she'd sniff every bunk, and she knew when the guys were out.
Uh-huh.
And she's just a good all-around dog.
Yeah.
American dog.
Do you know if you were ever exposed to any Agent Orange or defoliants?
We had several places. We didn't know it then. I subsequently had a book on Ranch Hand, Operation
mm-hmm.
Ranch Hand.
Right.
And this guy had a computerized, I don't know where the hell he got his map from, but... you know, the names of cities and everything was screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
But he had the sites that where they had run these ancient Agent Orange and Agent Purple and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, of course, my four trips to Vietnam was with an A-team. And, you know, that's where we were, border
right.
surveillance, you know.
Right.
And along the highways and the byways and the canals and stuff like that, they used it pretty much. But, yeah... We had one place there that we actually saw stuff we went in for what they call a BDA, a bomb damage assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, you could see it on the leaves, this, you know, like if you sprayed DDT or something, you know, the old hand sprayers,
mm-hmm.
it'd leave that like a white residue or, you know, like a scum on the foliage. That type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you never figured it was, you know, it came from Americans, you know. Something blew up or, you know, some type of ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we had heard about the you know, the fire bases and stuff like that. And we had fire bases all around, you know, between us and the Cambodian border.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to coordinate, you know, if we were in the AO, you know, we'd get their frequencies and talk to them and well, look, you know, don't send any ambushes out to this, you know, this block of coordinates, you know, because we're going to be operating there, and we don't want to fire you guys up. We don't want you firing us up.
Right.
And, yeah, we, all along that, you know, not only just locked in, but several of the camps were sprayed.
When you think back at this last year, your last tour there, any memorable incidents or missions that come to mind when you think about it?
Well, we went in on the Cambodian incursion.
Mm-hmm.
Me and George Reeves went in with 85 little people.
Right.
Right into a cache there. Hell, they had triangulated 37 millimeters on the ground. Luckily, they weren't occupied
mm-hmm.
when we came in.
Right.
But... we had arms, weapons, uniforms. We found thousands of Chinese bicycles. We had helicopters coming over. We'd lined up 10 and 12 bicycles. There was guys getting killed over in the base camps over there driving these motors or these bicycles because they didn't have any brakes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I guess the NVA or the porters, whatever, you know, use their feet.
Mm-hmm.
Their hands, you know, because they don't ride them. They just load them up like a pack horse.
Mm-hmm.
But we had weapons. Guys were coming for weapons, bicycles, flags,
mm-hmm.
food. There was all kinds of stuff there. And then that's when the NVA were just walking around, you know.
Right.
they didn't know what, because they had major units coming from, we hella lifted in from Loch Ninh.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were 10 miles in into Cambodia, and then I got pulled out and went with another unit that was 15 miles further in with another American.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were there, and there was no water, any water anywhere around there. So we were hurting for water, and they finally, after about 3 or 4 days, they got us some water. And the next day we got blown up. So both of us were, both Americans were medevac.
What happened?
We think it was a B-40. We were there. We made contact again. We made contact early that morning,
mm-hmm.
and they broke and run. We went after them, and they set up an ambush and hit us again. And we had called in gunships,
mm-hmm.
and they were hosing them. And we're not sure if it was an American rocket, because it was only one.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually fire them, I think, in multiples. So it was probably a B-40 rocket that got us. But it wounded me, wounded the other American, killed the guy behind me,
hmm.
and wounded the radio operator. And but, you know, we were in control.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just that, you know, one misfortune, the two mm-hmm. Americans. You know, the other guy, Pat, was calling in the air on the radio, and mm-hmm. he called it for close. I forget what the wording is, but he wanted it real close.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think it was a B-40. I don't think it was a rocket from. I think it would have done a hell of a lot more damage, I think, than a B-40.
Mm-hmm. You were medevaced out.
Yeah. They came in and got us at a jungle penetrator.
Where did they take you?
I forget, some hospital near Saigon, outside of Saigon.
How long did you recover? What were your wounds like?
I got hit in the arm.
Uh-huh.
I got hit in the leg, and I couldn't move my arm. My hand, my hand wouldn't function.
Hmm. Nerve damage?
At that time, as it turns out. That they just let the shrapnel in there,
huh.
and you know, the use of the hand came back, you know.
Uh-huh.
But when I was there, I just couldn't use it. I couldn't, you know, I had to use a weapon with the left hand.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I went over to see what was wrong with Pat. He mm-hmm. was just about to, he got the back of his neck got sliced open with a piece of shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember where else he got hit, but I was more worried about him. And I told him, I said, I'll give you half a syringe of morphine. You know, he says, no, I'll give you a syringe of morphine. I said, fuck you. You know, he ain't giving me no morphine. Eh? So we're there, you know, refusing morphine.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it was good to see that, the jungle penetrator come in.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, like I said, we'd been without water for, couple of days, and
mm-hmm.
we had just gotten water. So, but as soon as that chopper landed, I think they refueled on the way to. Maybe that's where they refueled in Hong Kong, I guess, or something like that. But anyway, they had, the medics there were handing out cold beer when the chopper landed.
Wow.
We had a nice ice cold beer, and of course that, you know, we split there because I was wounded in the arm and the leg. Mm-hmm. Arm and a leg, and Crowley, being a, they classified it as a head wound,
mm-hmm.
because it was in his neck, so he went to another hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we were both out of there in 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
The surgeon from A Company, Special Forces doctor, mm-hmm. came in and got us sprung.
Did you go back to your camp?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Of course, you know, they gave us a couple of days in Saigon.
Right. How did it feel going into Cambodia, hitting some of their sanctuaries?
Well, it's pretty much we're doing what we were doing in, you know, in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the terrain was pretty much the same, except it was his backyard.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Should that have happened earlier? Sending forces into Cambodia and into Laos in force to take care of these sanctuaries?
Yes and no. Yes, that if they knew they were, you know, liable mm-hmm. to attack, they would have had to, you know, do things differently too.
Mm-hmm.
Large units. I think the B-52 strikes, had they not been, you know, told about it,
mm-hmm.
were pretty effective. We were within five clicks. I think they told us we were on an operation to get a message from the base camp saying, where's your RON? You know, where are you moving to? You know, and they pretty much know where we're going, but mm-hmm. you know. A lot of guys won't tell them exactly where they're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them knowing it. But they said, well, you need to get the hell out of where you are now because there's going to be a lot of stuff going off there. They had a full arc light going into this one area.
Mm-hmm.
And so we bagged up and got what we thought was a safe distance away. And we were about five clicks from the main arc light, and that ground shook like an earthquake. I mean, it was just awesome. You could hear them going over. You can hear them open the bomb bay doors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're held, I don't know, what, 40, 50,000 feet in the air?
They're over 30,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you hear that growl, you know, growl.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, I was in a hammock, you know. I slept in a hammock.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd dig a slit trench underneath the hammock. And, man, it was just, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was just swinging all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It was really impressive.
What other missions or incidents come to your mind besides the incursion into Cambodia on this last tour?
I try to get out with my junior medic. He's a real good dude. He's a Florida boy. He's
mm-hmm.
a lieutenant in the Florida State Police now.
Mm-hmm.
I got sick. I got the runs.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go back to camp, so. Yeah, I wanted to go out and spend a week with him, or, you know, at least a few days out in the woods with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was getting ready to rotate, you know, only less than a week left. But I guess running, running Highway 13,
mm-hmm.
We had a Jeep and a 2.5 deuce, usually made the run down to Han Kwan to buy stuff at the PX.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally we'd go by truck, and
mm-hmm.
you know, there's always APCs blowing up, and, you know, mines and stuff. And right down the street from where we had the camp, three Americans got killed in, I think it was 66, 65.
Mm-hmm.
But they got ambushed down there.
Oh, yeah?
And me and this guy, George Reeves, we used to go down there just before dark, get
mm-hmm.
down there and drink beer,
mm-hmm.
and then come back through the rubber and in a 106 Jeep. But, it was a setup, you know. The
mm-hmm.
incoming team was their captain and the team sergeant, and the team sergeant and the captain from the team that was leaving
mm-hmm.
were going down there to you know, show him around, and Charlie was waiting on him, and did him a job.
Why do you think you spent so much time in the country on such dangerous missions? Why do you think you were spared? I mean, how did that? Was that just luck? Was it skill?
I think it's just luck and street savvy, you know. But
mm-hmm.
most of it's just it wasn't to be.
Mm-hmm.
Good friend, the guy I wrote the letter to, telling him, so I said, come on, a nice
mm-hmm.
camp, you know,
right.
easy day, come on down. He got gut shot, and another, it was, I think, northeast of Loch Ninh. The LLEB didn't like to go there, and we finally got it in, and they made contact, and he got wounded, gut shot, medevaced out, and they were going to medevac him back to Hokie.
Mm-hmm.
And he damn near died in the aircraft, so he landed in the Philippines. And doctored them up some more there. But that was the first time I'd gotten out of camp in 3 months, was to go see him.
Wow.
Well, you know, the initial medevac was the hospital there in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him there, and then he, like I say, he was being medevaced back to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And something happened. He busted open or something in the aircraft, and they landed in the Philippines.
Did he make it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
He, the poor bastard, he ended up getting the same wounds he had. They opened him up again, and they found some wire that they had used to wire sutures.
Mm-hmm.
But they also found that he had cancer of the pancreas.
Mm. Oh, so boy.
So he was a control freak. He got to the point where he couldn't do for himself, so he committed suicide. Took a .45 and put a round in his heart.
Hmm.
But
when did that happen?
April of '95.
Okay.
But there was a picture taken of three guys. The guy that sent me the letter,
mm-hmm.
me and the guy that I wrote the letter to were standing in front of the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because all three of those guys got cancer. And it's all attributed to Agent Orange.
Oh, yeah?
Two got prostate cancer, and Kenny got that, pancreatic cancer.
Mm-hmm. So you got prostate cancer.
I got prostate cancer. Lee Carter got prostate cancer. And the other guys I haven't really been in contact with. Well, Mountain Yard Maynard,
mm-hmm.
and Rotten Roger, and those guys, I have no idea what kind of... But so many people, this is, what, 5 or 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
one of the guys from our SF association was saying we lost 239 people to cancers, either prostate, brain, or lungs.
Hmm. And you're saying that's not a coincidence?
No, it can't be a coincidence.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that amount of people, and this is, you know, 5, 10 years ago.
Right.
239 guys, and the guys I know that never even made it off the operating table.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all brain cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer. And, you know, in the case of Kenny, it was pancreatic cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't have known it had they not opened him up to clean up his wound, you
right.
know.
Right. When you were getting ready to leave, or when you're getting really short to leave in June 1970, did you know, again, when you were leaving, or was this something that just came out of the blue?
No. It's, you know, your PCS was coming up.
Okay.
So I pretty much knew, and I pretty much knew I was going back to Oki, too, because ordinarily I'd have been sent stateside, but
mm-hmm.
I told him, you know, hey, send me to Okinawa, man. Don't waste the time sending me to the States.
And you stayed there another, what, 18 months or so?
From the summer of 70 mm-hmm. to the summer of 72.
And what did you do when you were there?
Again, training.
Still training?
Yeah, that 1 6-month stint down in Marshall Islands.
Mm-hmm.
We're down in an atoll down there. We built several water catchments. Built a school,
mm-hmm.
or a couple of schools actually.
Mm-hmm.
Rebuilt a seaplane ramp. Cleared the runway. They had a 7,000 foot Jap runway.
Mm-hmm.
We cleared the coconut trees off of that, so they could get a little airport.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of work. Worked 7 days a week.
Yeah.
For 6 months.
Did you know you were not going back to Vietnam, or
no,
was that a possibility?
No, because we still had in '73, in '72, we still had TDY teams going.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they had what was FANC and a couple other acronyms for training Cambodians and
mm-hmm.
different ethnic groups over there. Right up until 75, I think.
Mm-hmm. So there was always a possibility that you would go back.
Oh, yeah. You knew it was going to happen again. You know,
did you want to?
Sure. It's, you know.
And why weren't you sent back, though?
Well, one thing is, the reason I didn't get extended on Okinawa is because I wasn't on the island. I was down there in the Marshall Islands. I couldn't do the paperwork.
Right. Okay.
And you couldn't trust anybody to run it through for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so subsequently they said, okay, it's time to go back anyway, because I think it was 6 years overseas. They had to rotate you back for an eye operation or something.
Mm-hmm. What was it like going back to the United States after spending that much time over in Asia?
Well, actually, as soon as I left, I got into, I think it was San Francisco, and I took a plane to Washington, D.C., and went to change clothes at the little fort there in the men's room, changed clothes, went to the Pentagon, and requested to go back to Okinawa.
And what'd they say to you?
He said, get out of here. He said, you're lucky to even get into Special Forces. Get the hell out of here. So I reported back down to Fort Bragg.
Uh-huh.
At that time, there was a brain drain. They thought that there's too much talent in Special Forces. They needed to spread it around, so they were taking different MOSs and assigning them to leg units, and, civilian component, National Guard, Reserve, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I was lucky to get back to Bragg, but I didn't know it at the time. I just cried like a monkey eating onions. I wanted to go back to Okie.
What was your reception back in the United States, in San Fran, and then in Washington, D.C.? Any problems at all?
Not for me, no.
No? Okay.
It was one humorous thing.
Yeah?
When I was going back to Khantoum when my mom died, I was flying out of LAX, and I'm sitting there reading something. And I was in uniform, and I was going back on a civilian aircraft. And sitting there, and I get the presence, you get that feeling. And I look up, and there's about five or six guys there, all in these suits, white shirts and ties. And I think, oh, holy Christ. I said, this is either, a Mormon convention or or it's the FBI, But what it was, as it turns out, it was Israeli intelligence folks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
And they saw the patch and the beret. They just wanted to chat.
Oh, yeah.
But I was really surprised. They were there for some type of training or meeting or something. I forget what the hell.
Is it the Mossad?
I'm not sure if it was Mossad.
Uh-huh.
Or, they brushed things off,
But was it a friendly chat? A good time?
Oh, yeah. They were just interested in how things in Nam, you're going back. And,
right.
Because we had a fella at Loch Ninh, who he later committed suicide also, a fellow named Eric Canstein, who's a lieutenant. He was our XO.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad was a stockbroker in Boston. But evidently, he got recruited. The Israeli intelligence, I guess either the Mossad or one of the military intelligence people. And they were looking for headhunters to interdict the Arabs coming into Israel proper, and they paid a flat rate plus whatever you caught, killed, or captured. And he turned it down because he already had a good job going back to Boston. But something happened to him. I don't know what flipped him off, but he ended up committing suicide.
Let me ask you a couple of general questions about your Vietnam experience before we leave there and talk about back in the United States. Thinking back over all that time, are there particular brave incidents that come to mind?
Brave?
Yeah, anything that you just will always remember happening.
Not offhand. I mean, it's your perception of bravery, it's, I think there's guys that, they're brave to the point of being foolhardy, taking unwarranted chances. But no, I think it was so commonplace, I can't think of anything where, you would say bravery, because I didn't believe in writing people up for medals. I never wrote a person up for a medal.
Why not?
Because I figured it was our job. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, if it was something really exceptional, yeah. You know, we're, but for us, you know, to, you know, I mean, I've seen people write themselves up and forward it.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, air medals. You know, we used to ride the you know, they're armed helicopters, but they just had machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go at dawn and dusk. We'd go out and just to kill time, something to do,
mm-hmm.
and bullshit with the pilots. We'd go fly a door gunner for the night or the morning or whatever. You know, looking for bunkers or folks or whatever, mm-hmm. and see if anything new in the AO, and it'd give the door gunners a chance to stay back, you know, have a night in the club, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, guys, oh, I got, you know, keeping logs of their hours and all this shit. And, you know.
Yeah.
No, I don't think, and most of the guys were like that. Some guys were crazy, were middle crazy, you know. That's I guess they saw that as a way to, you know, to progress in the Army or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you recall any really humorous events? Does anything come to mind?
Oh, there's several, really. One that just popped in when I thought back of people coming out in strings.
Mm-hmm.
Two guys, old Doc Barnes and Roland Marquis, were coming out on strings. And at that time, we were having a moon war.
Mm-hmm.
Who could think up the latest moon, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
the latest moon?
Yeah, you know, you drop your trousers and wiggle.
Ah, okay.
That's mooning.
Right, right.
So we'd find different ways of mooning people.
Okay.
And old Marquis and Doc Barnes are coming out on strings.
Mm-hmm.
And Barnes is, his lips are moving. You know, you're only you know, maybe 60, 80 feet below the chopper.
Mm-hmm.
On these ropes. And the noise of the chopper and the down blast from the rotors.
Mm-hmm.
And Marquis could see Barnes' lips moving. He yells at him, you know, he pulls him closer and he yells at him, "What the hell are you talking about? I can't hear a damn thing you're talking. What the hell are you talking about?" He says, "I ain't talking to you, asshole." He says, "I'm praying." And then Marquis mooned him.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
But that, you know, right offhand, I don't know.
Well, tell me what your impressions of Vietnam itself, the country, the countryside.
It was beautiful. It's really a lush country. In and around Loch Ninh there, even mm-hmm. with the arc lights and the bombs and all that, it's still a beautiful place, and it was really pristine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like an Eden. You could, you know, if you liked hot peppers with your food, you could go over to a bush and pick hot peppers off the bush. Mm-hmm. You had fruit trees out grown wild.
Mm-hmm.
You know, animals, critters. They had little barking deer. Mm-hmm. There, you know, several guys had, you know, shot tigers up in the highlands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a really, really beautiful country. It's, you know, the Orient. You know, it's just what you would think. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And the cities weren't that bad. They weren't that dirty, or you know. But you know, most of the American guys, were, you know, they just wanted it out of there. You know.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like it. They didn't like it before they even got there. You know, so it just carried over into a dislike for the country. Or,
mm-hmm. I take it from you that you didn't have that attitude.
No, I loved it. I thought that was great. I think I told you before, I never served anywhere but Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Never did get to Germany, and I figured that's, you know, where the business was. So.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I did volunteer for Berlin to attachment. And but at the time I got married, and I married an Oriental, and the mission of the Berlin detachment was to stay behind. If the Russians had overtaken Berlin, then they would, you know, just meld into the local populace. And you can't do that with married to an Oriental. You
right.
know, you don't look German.
Did you meet her in Okinawa?
No, I met her in the States here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's Korean. She's not Japanese.
Okay. What can you say about the Vietnamese civilians?
Most of them were pretty straightforward. They're pretty good people. You know, you got the, just like Americans, you know, they get some trying to, you know, sell you, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge or, you know. But they do that to their own people, too. So. But more than most of them, I got along with pretty well. I liked them. Some I really liked. Like this one fellow we worked with in 63. I later ended up in the same camp with him in 65. And he was a good. He was a professional soldier. He was really, he was a commo man. And he didn't go out much because, you know, they kept him close because, you know, communications with their higher, you know. And but he was a heck of a nice guy. I really liked him, and he had a good attitude. You know, it, again, they're special forces, you know. And until it got politicized, you know, and the Saigon Cowboys got in and did their thing, you know. But you could pretty much tell the professionals.
Yeah. When you got back to the States, how difficult was it for you to transition back into to life in the United States?
It wasn't hard at all. It's, you know, it's just the opposite of leaving. You know, you're homesick for where you just left. You know, it's the two best assignments you're gonna have. You know, it's the one you're leaving and the one you're going to.
So it wasn't hard for you at all.
No, not at all.
Did people ask you about your experience in Vietnam? Do you talk about it with anybody?
If they asked, I'd talk. But you know, some of them, you know, again, you gotta size them up, you know. Some people just you know, oh, no, I don't want to know about that. Tell me about the killing. You cut anybody's ears off. You know?
Right.
It's that kind of crap. You cut them off at the ankles, you know. But, you know, if they had a legitimate question, sure, I'd answer that.
Yeah?
No qualms.
What was your opinion of the anti-war movement?
I really didn't understand it. You know, I saw pictures, you know, in the Stars and Stripes, or, you know, you hear about this or that, and, you know, the hippies. And at that time, I don't remember hearing about the, you know, the veterans against the Vietnam War. But, you know, you hear about these guys throwing their medals, you know. But we also knew there was a lot of wannabes doing this crap. That, you know, they never went to Vietnam. They never did anything, you know. But, you know, if a guy didn't like it, that's his bag. I work with a guy right now that he told me, look at me dead in the eye, and, and we're not close friends, you know, because we don't socialize together, but we have a good working relationship. And he said that he'd have gone to goddamn Canada.
Really?
Yeah.
How'd that affect you?
Well, you know, I didn't let on, but, you know, I had thought more of him, knowing that he was, you know, he put his service in. But had he been drafted, he'd have gone to Canada or Mexico or whatever.
Did he know you had served?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But he didn't care. You know, he figured I could look at it, you know. And, you know, his thinking was that, you know, he would be killed. And that he wasn't going to get killed. He was going to Canada rather than to go.
Okay.
But, you know, to me, there's other ways of, you know, serving your country than being in the Army or the Air Force, Navy, Marines, or Coast Guard, you know. We had a, when I was in medic training there at Fort Sam, we had a bunch of conscientious objectors, you know. And hell, they didn't mind being in the Army. They didn't mind going to war. Mm-hmm. They just wouldn't kill anybody.
Right.
Or carry a weapon, you know. And they were, you know, superb. I thought they were great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we met a lot of young guys in language school there. The ASA, like I say, this ASA and, you know, the intelligence people all went to some type of language school. So
mm-hmm.
we got a good mix in there. But
mm-hmm.
if a guy legitimately disliked or, you know, because of his religion or whatever, then that's all well and good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to gang up and, you know, one guy fires up another guy, you know, and it's easy to, you know, just to do things because you feel like doing them, you know. Like,
mm-hmm.
But there were things that we didn't understand, you know, the riots in Detroit and Watts. And, you know, what the hell is going through these people's minds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, like I say, I think I lost about 10 years of news and music and,
mm-hmm.
and what people were like back in the States because, you know, I didn't really associate with. And then, you know, if you are back in the States, you're at a military base anyway, so you're...
Mm-hmm.
You're with the people pretty much think the same way you do.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the media coverage of the war?
I didn't like it. When we went into the Cambodian incursion, they sent us some news people, I think from CBS.
Mm-hmm.
And
they went with you?
Well, they tried to. I've run them off. I wouldn't let them come in. I just didn't want them in there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't need any, you know, snooping in the... of what we're doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent him over to the 1st Air Cav, I think. But we had an incident in 65 where I and another guy had two companies, and Rudy Cooper and someone else had two companies, and we left camp, I guess about, you know, maybe midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to walk to an objective, two different routes.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy was going to hit the objective, and we were going to be the blocking force. Well, they hit the objective, but there was more folks there than they thought, and they were well entrenched, and they had a lot of problems. They had a call in air, and they lost a lot of folks assaulting this one bunker complex.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this reporter, well... before that, the troops were taking fire and they took a lot of casualties, and when they did overrun the bunker complex, they went in and they got this one bunker, and I don't know, excuse me, if the guy was dead already or he was alive at the time, whatever, but they cut his head off, and it was this particular bunker that really, you know, hosed the CAM boats.
Mm-hmm. So the Cambodians cut the head off.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he had took the guy's scarf and wrapped it around the head, and he was carrying the head back, and this reporter took pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the son of a gun, when the choppers come in to get the medevac, the wounded,
mm-hmm.
and the dead, the son of a gun jumps on a chopper. He wants to go. And he wants to go get this picture of this guy carrying this guy's head.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to get, you know, he's going to get the Nobel Prize or something, you know, or a Peabody Award or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, or whatever. And this guy's knocking people, wounded people out of the way so he can get on a damn chopper and get back to Saigon.
Mm.
So Rudy radioed ahead and told him, said, get that son of a gun off of there and get his camera. And that's what they did.
Oh, yeah?
And he was blackballed after that. He never got a ride anywhere.
But overall, the overall coverage, you had a problem with it?
Like I say, the only coverage we really had was what we could get on the Transoceanic,
mm-hmm.
and you know, Stars and Stripes, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what you know, my parents, I think, sent me some newspapers from you know, the local newspaper. It might be old, but you know, you can pretty much tell the way that they're going, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, but I just didn't like people coming in and, you know, we've had several people interviewed that, you know, they just ignored it, what the hell they said, and just, you know, printed what they wanted anyway. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I just didn't want them around.
Has your opinion changed any since the war?
No, not really.
What do you think about the media coverage today of the current conflict?
Well, I think it was a good idea to, I forget the word they used.
Embed them?
Embed them, yeah, good word. I don't know who thought it up, but I think it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And at least they were prepared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they made them go through a mini boot camp, you know,
right,
and got them in shape. And, at least let them know how to stay the hell out of the way when they needed to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good idea, and I think...
Mr. Brady, let me interrupt you just for a moment. I need to change out the disc.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just so controlled. I mean, the sniper incident there in Virginia and
mm-hmm.
D.C. in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, they just so overload you with so much stuff. That, and they're inventing things, you know, to make a big hullabaloo to sell papers or to sell TV time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And,
how much did you keep up with the war effort once you left, once you got back in the States? And really, this is when the United States is really pulling out the Vietnamization policies in place, and
yeah,
we're getting ready to withdraw completely.
Yeah, well, when I left in 70, they were turning the camp over to, that September,
mm-hmm.
they were turning the camp over to the Vietnamese, they call them ranger camps or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to the guys that left, and he says, hey, as soon as they turned the camp over, hell, they were ripping the wires out to get the copper and,
oh, gosh,
you know, the lights and all that stuff. And
right.
One of the guys that got captured after that, a fellow named Mark Smith,
mm-hmm.
who I knew as a Spec 4, I think he's a colonel now or a lieutenant colonel, retired, but he got captured, and he said he knew he was passing locked in, but he could smell where the NVA had, you know, slaughtered the Cambodians, and,
mm-hmm.
and they had bulldozers. They just bulldozed over the bunkers.
Mm.
But he could smell the dead, you know, dead meat, and he knew it was locked in. He knew he was on his way to Cambodia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you think that the Vietnamization policy had any chance of succeeding?
I thought so. I did.
Yeah.
But
why did you think that?
I thought that, you know, that we had enough people advising these, you know, these big infantry divisions, and you know, their military was kind of streamlined like ours. You
mm-hmm.
know, I figured, hell, you know, these guys have got to be capable. You know, they must be, you know, to be able to fight a war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess I was wrong. Or they didn't have the will to fight, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I thought they could swing it. I didn't really expect it to end like it did.
Right. How did you feel in 73 when the United States officially pulled out and ended their participation, for the most part?
Well, I forget really what I felt at the time, but I'm sure it wasn't too swift a maneuver in my mind, but
mm-hmm.
I knew then too, though. But you know, we had people over there at TDY, like with Fank and some other you know, the training
mm-hmm.
men,
mm-hmm.
MTTs. But I thought they could swing it, if not to prolong it, you know, or to, you know, to get to a where they'd negotiate, you know, another Korea or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
another Panmunjom or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What about in April 75 when the country completely collapsed?
Oh, Lord, I just couldn't believe it. And, you know, it's, you know, when you think of the good guys that did fight for their country over there, you know, the Cambodians and Nungs and the mountain yards and a lot of Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
That the poor bastards were going to, you know, they're all going to get, you know, slaughtered, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a, you know, a waste to me, you know.
Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned from its engagement in Vietnam?
Well, I think they better learn that if they're not going to go over there to win, don't go.
Mm-hmm.
And if they haven't learned it, then we're going to be in big trouble. And I think we're going to be in big trouble in Africa. I think Africa is just, you know, the old adage that never fight a land war in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Africa is the same way. I think you're going to get mired down and... I mean, those people have been killing each other and eating each other for years. Idi Amin just died,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he was supposed to have been a cannibal.
Right.
And he was trained by the British.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that a country that poor, and I don't think they could find, other than, you know, in South Africa, you know,
mm-hmm.
Mandela. That guy's a saint, you know, to
mm-hmm.
spend 30 years in jail, you know. And, but you know, I think if we get involved in Africa as the United States, you know, if it's a joint, you know, with France and Germany and whoever,
mm-hmm.
that's fine. But just to take it on ourselves, and I think it's going to be a waste of manpower and a waste of youth.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about your service in Vietnam today, looking back?
I was okay with it. You know, like I said, that was my job. I was
mm-hmm.
That was my living. I was a professional soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely believe that you didn't need soldiers back in the United States. You hire these guys, you train them,
mm-hmm.
get them out there.
Mm-hmm.
Get them out defending the country. You're not going to defend them, you know, sitting back at the desk somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would change about your experience, if you could?
Oh, yeah, Lord. I think I'd... Believe it or not, I would have trained harder.
Really?
Yeah, I think I'd have paid more attention to detail,
mm-hmm.
especially like in language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd change some things, but you know, you say that, but you know, at the circumstances that you were under, you know, that you say you would change, but you might not have the opportunity to change.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to phrase it. You know that you don't really choose the times that you're going to be over there.
Mm-hmm.
But the times that I went, I guess, were pretty fortuitous because, you know, other than, you know, stepping on that mine in '65,
mm-hmm.
and getting blown up in Cambodia. You know, minor stuff, you know, over the years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wonder why, you know, why was I fortunate, or why was I, you know, supposed to go there or
mm-hmm.
and not go somewhere else or whatever. But it's just fate, you know, and like we were talking about before, luck.
Right.
It's luck and street savvy, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You spent a tremendous amount of time on the ground there.
Well, you know, my tours, that's probably an average, I'd say, pretty much, you know, for a 20-year man.
Mm-hmm.
To get at least two tours, two PCS tours.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough to, you know, to go TDY and go TDY from, you know, the States and from Okinawa.
Right.
And... it was, you know, a broad spectrum of the war, you know, from
mm-hmm.
63, from, you know, the guerrilla type war to, you know, mainline units, you know,
right.
1970.
How has the war most affected your life?
Oh, shoot. I don't know. I met some of the greatest men in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, I belong to a few fraternal organizations, the Special Operations Association, the Special Forces Association, the VFW American Legion, the DAV, and I never did join the Military Order of the Purple Heart, or there's another one I didn't join.
Is there a particular reason why you didn't join that?
No, just, you know, they can't afford it. It's just, right. You know, between my job now and, you know, supporting the church, supporting the family, and I got a lot of stuff.
Yes, sir.
As soon as you join, you know, they start hitting on you, and you hate to tell them no. But it would just take too much of my time. Plus, most of these organizations, you get in there and you get shooting the breeze and drink a few beers, you know. And it's fine socially, you know. It's just time consuming. And the more organizations you belong to, like one organization, we only meet once a year in Las Vegas. But, you know, you maintain, you know, relationships other than just, you know, meeting for that one time. But, no, they're good organizations, and I support them. And I make it, you know, a point if I do join, like the DAV. The reason I did join is to just show my support. The chapters we have here are mostly World War II vets. And Korean War vets, and I got a healthy respect for them people. Because they're the ones that trained me, you know, as a recruit and a young hood, in the early 60s.
Yes, sir.
And as long as they, you know, accepting that, then I'll join. I don't care. But it's just to show support, and I'm not running for office. I'm not seeking a position or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam?
Oh, I'd love to.
Yeah. What would you do if you went back?
Shoot, I don't really know. I'd probably like to go back to Loch Ninh and see what the heck is left of that place. And maybe down into the Delta. I took a lot of pictures. I took some pictures, and my teammates took pictures. That was one thing I would change if I went back. I would take more pictures than of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But we used to go out, and me and the junior commo man and the junior engineer, we'd go out at night, go outside the gate, and they had a little beer joint there, and
there's
a little restaurant, really, like, you know, we call them Howard Johnson's, you know, they push carts, and that type of thing. And we'd go out there, and we'd have a beer or two, and the little kids, you know, would all come around, and they just go crazy to see hair on people's arms.
Right.
And they come up and they feel you, touch you, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they had these two twin little girls that we half-assed adopted, you know. We could get stuff in the mail, you know, for them. And
mm-hmm.
But I took pictures of them and the two adults, the two brothers that were the fathers of these, you know, there's probably 10 or 15 kids.
I heard
later that the Viet Cong came in and assassinated those two hoods. And I often wondered what the heck happened, you know, to those little kids, how they fared.
Mm-hmm.
But we had one kid that I think I told you about Dallas Chapman.
Yes.
And they named the kid Chapman.
Mm-hmm.
And Dallas got him a little set of fatigues made, you know. And in fact, I just talked to Dallas here a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
He moved to Florida from Colorado, and he often wonders what the hell happened to Chapman,
mm-hmm.
little kid.
Yeah.
But do you
go see movies about Vietnam?
I went and saw because I wanted to take my wife to see it. We were soldiers once and young,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen excerpts of Platoon. I've seen excerpts of... Kenny, just before I left for Texas, took me to see Rambo.
Okay.
So I saw the first Rambo.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any of the subsequent. But, nah.
Why not?
There's no need to. You know, it's, you know, even with the, we were soldiers once, mm-hmm. in Young. It's a good story. You know, it's a good read.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all the special effects and all this stuff, you know, Charlie wasn't stupid. You know, you never fired from behind a tree, or, you know, most mm-hmm. of the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just, it was, they had to do it to show numbers of troops and numbers of troops in maneuver and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But special effects and that, and things that I didn't think were necessarily, you know, I saw the deer hunter.
Uh-huh.
And that was wacky. And I think I fell asleep during Marlon Brando. And
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I used to love war movies as a kid, you know, but
uh-huh.
it just didn't move me one way or another. I did love Forrest Gump, though. I really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah. What would you tell the younger generation today about Vietnam?
Oh, shoot. Oh, I don't know. I guess you'd have to, you know, I don't know how these kids think today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a war. It wasn't a police action. It was a war.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that you were, you know, doing something that your country wanted you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, everybody decided, well, I'm not going to do that because, you know, it might hurt, you know, the monkeys in the jungle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do it, you know. And if everybody thought that way, hell, you know, nobody would go over there. I don't like rice. I'm not going, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I think you owe something to this country, and not necessarily by joining the Army or going to Vietnam or going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You owe something to the country, and you need to you know, pay back.
Mm-hmm.
But the kids I've talked to are pretty level-headed. They understand that, you know, that it was certain things were tragic. And but there's things coming out now, like that poor little girl running down the street naked.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, all her clothes were burned off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not necessarily so, you know.
Right.
And they're blaming the Americans. Well, from what I understand now, they know that it was a Vietnamese aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
That did the napalming.
That's right.
So, you know, but that picture's burned into the sensitivity of how many millions of people, you know, American baby killers, maimers,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, we did a lot of good over there. I was just telling the guys at work here the other day, we were talking about deformed kids. And while I was there at Loc Ninh, I heard about this French dentist that was fixing hair lips.
Mm-hmm.
And we had several hair lip kids in there. And one kid had a cleft palate and the hair lip.
Mm-hmm.
And his hands were webbed, hands and feet.
Wow.
And poor little critter, you know, he's a hell of a good little sport, you know. He didn't mm-hmm. understand English, you know, but you know, mess around with him, tickle him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Go see him on the, you know, on the operation. We'd stop by in Village 7 and see this kid. Well, mm-hmm. I got a hold of the French doctor and told him about it. Anyway, they got him fixed. And they wouldn't free up his hands or his feet because they thought he was functioning already, but they did fix his cleft palate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sending kids to school and, you know, orphanages and stuff like that. And, did a lot of good.
Mm-hmm.
Not just, you know,
mm-hmm.
not a bunch of ogres, you know.
Yes,
and
sir.
Like I say, we melded in with the population. We weren't, you know, if we went to the woods with the little people, we ate what they ate, you know, and shared what we had.
Mm-hmm.
So,
have you ever been to the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington?
No. I drove around it one time, but I didn't go. I've been to the little one they had out here in Dallas. They
mm-hmm.
had the small wall there in
mm-hmm.
in the Restland Cemetery there. I didn't go by that.
What was your experience like?
Kind of ambivalent, I think. I feel bad. You know, there's guys that were killed in Nam that are not getting recognition that, you know, guys that are dying here, you know, after long after the war is over, you know. The guys that I know that got killed were, you know, regular guys. It's a shame they got killed, and you feel bad, and you know, that they never got a chance to do or see things that you were able to do because you survived, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the wall itself, I don't need that kind of a reminder. You know, the guys that I know that are dead, you know, the old saying that, you know, as long as people are thinking of you or can remember you, you know, you're never really forgotten. So.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't need a monument to remind me of the guys that got killed. On my computer at work, I get we got a website called the Team House, and then the SF and the SOA have their their own thing. But they got the wall itself. You can call up anybody that's on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll give you a short blurb, you know, when they died.
Right.
Basically how, or, you know, if their body was recovered or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other sites on there, though, that you can look up and actually see, you know, coordinates where they got killed or became missing or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's I think they're just building too many. You know, even the SOA, they took a vote and said, they're going to build this monument to special ops people down there in MacDill Air Force Base. So, you know, we're going to give them so many thousands of dollars, you know, to build this monument. And it's a nice little monument.
Mm-hmm.
But then they got some other grab-ass stuff that, you know, okay, the center is going to be for Medal of Honor winners only, and then on either side of that, they'll have generals and colonels, and it started getting politicized and that type of thing. But, you know, instead of building a monument, you know, we had the best remembrance of our dead in scholarship fund.
Mm-hmm.
We got a scholarship fund in the Special Ops Association that's out of this world. I mean, they really do some good.
Mm-hmm.
And, I got friends that their kids took advantage of it, and it's a 4-year deal if you qualify, and your grades stay up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the best monument in the world. You don't need a bunch of that. We're going to be a country of monuments and no military.
Yes, sir. Well, Mr. Brady, is there anything else that you want to talk about or add to our discussions?
Oh, I think we covered just about everything in creation.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Sorry about the rambling. But
no, sir. I appreciate your time very much, and we will go ahead and end the oral history interview now with Mr. Martin Brady. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Richard.